Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you and welcome to the Sports Lounge. This is JC, and with me today is Cleveland Ray and Proof Negative. How are you two today?
Oh, I'm adequate.
Hello, everybody. I hope you're having a just as wonderful Saturday as I.
Okay, what we're going to talk about today is several topics. What I want to do is get some of the basic stuff out of the way. And the first thing I want to bring up is the Boxing Hall of Fame so that I can get that piece out of the way. The 2013 inductees is what I want to bring up. And for boxing, a lot of the 2013 inductees are back in the day, going all the way back into the 1800s, all the way forward. There's going to be one or two names that most people might know who they are. The first person on the list, in no particular order, is Arturo Gatti. He turned pro in 1991 and relocated to Jersey City, New Jersey, and he captured the U.S. Boxing Association Junior Lightweight title in 94 before defeating Tracy Harris Patterson for the IBF 130-pound belt in 1992. He also stopped Wilson Rodriguez in the sixth round in his first title defense and won a decision over Patterson in a rematch and knocked out Gabriel Ruelas in the fifth round in 1997. He relinquished his belt in 1997 to fight as a lightweight and was knocked out by Angel Manfredi in 1998. He lost two 10-round bouts against Yvonne Robinson, and after suffering a knockout in the fifth round of Oscar De La Hoya in a welterweight fight, he moved to a 140-pound division and fought three memorable bouts with Irish Mickey Ward, winning two of them. He also captured vacant WBC junior welterweight crown with a 12-round decision over Gianluca Blanco in 2004, and defended with a second-round knockout of Leonard Doran and a fifth-round knockout of Jesse Lahia. After a loss to Floyd Mayweather Jr., he fought three more times, and then he retired in 2007 with a record of 40 wins and 9 losses with 31 knockouts. He also died in Brazil in July of 2009. The next person is Virgil Hill. His nickname was Quicksilver. He was born in Clinton, Missouri, and grew up in Grand Forks, Williston, North Dakota. He compiled a 288-11 record as an amateur. He won middleweight silver medals in 1984 LA Olympics. He turned pro at Madison Square Garden in 1984, in his 19th bout in 1987, he defeated at the time lightweight heavyweight champ Leslie Stewart on a fourth round knockout. He defended the title 10 times, including a 12 round decision over Bobby Thiessen, a first-round knockout of James Kinchin, and a 12-round decision over Tyrone Frazier before losing the crown to Thomas Hitman Hearn. So that's two. That's the end right there. And then the next one is Myung-Woo Yu, who was born in Seoul, Korea. He turned pro in 82 at the age of 18 after going 4-1 as an amateur. He won 36 straight fights over a 9-year span, taking a vacant OPBF flyweight crown with a third-round knockout of Edgar Inocencio in 1984. He won the WBA light flyweight crown with a 15-round decision over Joey Olivo in 1985, and over the next 6 years, he defended his title a record-setting 17 times. He lost the WBA title in 1991 to Oroki Ioka, and then on a 12-round decision, and then he reclaimed the crown in 1992 with a 12-round decision over the same guy. So that's three. Wesley Ramey from Everett, Michigan. He turned pro in 1929. He had a very brief amateur career and became one of the star lightweights of the 1930s. In 32, he defeated former featherweight and juniorweight champion Benny Bass. And in 1933, he scored wins over future junior welterweight King Battling Shaw, former junior welterweight champ Johnny Jacek, and a 10-round win over lightweight champion Tony Canzarini. Jeff Smith, who was born Jerome Vincent Jeffers from New York City, fighting as Jeff Smith, turned pro in 1910. one of the most traveled fighters in history. They called him the Bayonne Globetrotter. He boxed in France, Australia, England, Canada, and Mexico. It is estimated he traveled nearly 500,000 miles during his 17-year career. An outstanding defensive fighter with an effective left hook. While in Australia, he bested Eddie McGuarty and Jimmy Clabby in 20-round decisions in 1914 before splitting two fights with Les Darcy the next year. Unable to secure a title fight, he earned recognition as the uncrowned middleweight champion and frequently fought light heavyweights and heavyweights, including Hall of Famer Georges Carpentier, Tommy Lahren, and Gene Tunney, before retiring in 1927. Joe Coburn, from Ireland, he immigrated to the U.S. at an early age and settled in New York City, became an apprentice bricklayer, and during his spare time, he studied boxing and began sparring. He turned pro in 1856, and his first fight battled Ned Price for 3 hours and 20 minutes in Boston, winning the decision after 160 rounds.
Wow.
He remained undefeated throughout his career, defeating Mike McCool in 67 rounds in 1863 and twice drawing with Jim Mace in 1871. Remember, back in those days, someone had to get knocked out or knocked down or back out. The next person is Arturo Hernandez from Huacalan, Mexico. He was widely regarded as one of the greatest managers in the history of Mexican boxing. He guided bantamweight champion Carlos Zarate and strawweight king Ricardo Lopez and bantamweight and featherweight champion Ruben Olivares. And he also worked with Lupe Pinto and Rafael Limon and Baby Casanova, Alfonso Zamora, Rodolfo Martinez, Gabriel Bernal. He worked with some, and he also worked with Alexis Arguello, which some people should know who he is. And so he was with 12 world champions and 37 Mexican national champions. The next person, everybody should know who he is, Mills Lane, out of Savannah, Georgia, took up boxing in the U.S. Marine Corps, and after an honorable discharge enrolled in the University of Nevada, Reno, and won NCAA boxing title in 1960. He graduated in 63 with a law degree and turned pro, compiling a 10-1 record before turning his attention to refereeing in 1964. He quickly earned a reputation as a no-nonsense referee, respected for fairness, judgment, and professionalism. In the late 70s, he coined his trademark pre-fight phrase, "Let's get it on," and became a fan favorite. He retired in 1998. Hold on for a sec. Okay, Jimmy Lennon Jr. out of Santa Monica, California. He graduated from UCLA with a psychology degree in 81, began teaching at a private school, and at the urging of his father, famed ring announcer Jimmy Lennon Sr., he announced his first fight in 1981 at the Forum in Inglewood. Widely hailed for his finesse, class, and flawless pronunciation of difficult names, Lennon often introduced foreign fighters in their native tongue. Since 1991, has been a ring announcer for Showtime's Championship Boxing. Okay, the next person is Ted Carroll from New York City, grew up in Greenwich Village, graduated from the High School of Commerce, and served 4 years in the Army, known as a master boxing cartoonist. His artwork graced the pages of the ring for more than 50 years, and he was also a frequent writer for the magazine. He provided insight of the top fighters and fights and authoring a series of the history of African-American fighters. And then the final recipient of the 2013 Hall of Fame for boxing, Colin Hart. He's from England. He developed a passion for boxing at a young age and began his journalism career at the Daily Herald in 1958 as a news reporter, joined the sports department in 1962 and began covering boxing 2 years later. After the Herald folded, he was boxing correspondent for the Sun newspaper. His first assignment for the paper in the United States was the first fight between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier at Madison Square Garden in 1971. He covered George Foreman, Ken Norton, Ali Foreman, Ali Frazier 3, Sugar Ray Leonard, Thomas Hearns 1, and bouts involving Lennox Lewis, Ken Buchanan, Joe Calzi, and Ricky Hatton. He retired in 2000 but returned to serve as the Sun's boxing columnist, the first British writer to win a Matt Fleischer Award for Excellence in Boxing Journalism in 2011. So this is the class of 2013. Something that I noticed in this class, there wasn't that many boxers.
So it was there was a lot of writers, basically, and people behind the scenes.
Correct, which tells me that the boxing world is getting watered down from the fighting standpoint.
Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of
concern. Hard when we as people living in the 21st century are voting for journalists in the 1930s for boxing. They must have everybody in that they wanted right now.
Right, and it's not like the NFL where we have people that we think should be in are still sitting out there. But the other thing, too, is look at the amount of individuals that they're putting in. It's quite a substantial list. So there's 11 people going in, and the NFL, at the very most, puts in 7. And how many does baseball put in, Bruce?
It could be anywhere from 0 to 5. They've had years where they've had none.
So that's the reason why this list seems to be watered down. So what were you getting ready to say, Cleveland Ray? I'm sorry.
I wasn't getting ready to say anything.
Okay. All right. But I look at this list, and the first thing I'm thinking is there's people. The reason why this list is showing. So quite a few behind-the-scenes guys, such as announcers and news reporters and such, and referees, is because of the fact that the caliber of boxers is getting depleted as we move forward in time. Correct me if
I'm
wrong.
And also, boxing is becoming less popular.
That is true, too. That is absolutely true.
Unless you count overseas, where the Philippines love Pacquiao, even though he's lost his last two. But outside of that, boxing just isn't what it once was.
I'm going to have to agree with you there. I'm actually turning into a UFC fan.
Mixed martial arts?
You got it. So I just wanted to point out that we do talk about things other than football and baseball and basketball, and to bring up, we try to bring up something that's somewhat current for all the other sports as well. Just to give everybody a surprise, a great example is PGA Golf starts January 3rd of 2013, and I will be riveted to see what happens in that first match. Hey, next thing I want to bring up is the NFL calendar for this weekend. All the games are on Sunday, by the way, just to let everybody know. So there is no Saturday games. There is no Monday night football game, and this is the last week to decide who gets in and who does not get in to the NFL playoffs. Most of the NFL fantasy football leagues had their championship games last week, and that I will be bringing up for some of the leagues that we currently have that's kind of affiliated with the radio station here. And the other thing I wanted to bring up as well is to see what you guys think about the matchup to come, as far as the teams that's already in and who's the team that you would not want to play against in the AFC in the playoffs and the NFC in the playoffs. So the first game that's going to be tied in is going to be the Tampa Bay Buccaneers at the Atlanta Falcons. The New York Jets will be going to the Buffalo Bills. The Baltimore Ravens will be going to the Cincinnati Bengals. That game, the reason why I'm pausing on that game is because Cincinnati and Baltimore, Cincinnati is the number 6 seed right now, and they're going to be the number 6 seed, so I'll continue on. The next game, which does matter, is the Chicago Bears at the Detroit Lions. Chicago has to win that game to have a chance to go into the playoffs. The Indianapolis Colts will be hosting the Houston Texans. If Indianapolis beats Houston, they can win the division.
Really? I didn't. Okay. That would be cool.
The
Houston has 14 wins, I believe. The Colts, if they only win this, have 11 games.
I thought Houston had less wins than that. I mean, less wins.
I don't think they have 14. I thought they had like 12.
And Indianapolis has 11, right?
That's how I see it. I could be wrong, but I'll pull it up.
I stand corrected. Houston has 12. Indianapolis has 10, so there's no way Indianapolis can win that division.
All right, I got you.
Okay. Carolina Panthers at the New Orleans Saints. The Philadelphia Eagles at the New York Giants. The Giants have to win and hope for other teams to lose to make it to the playoffs. The Cleveland Browns at the Pittsburgh Steelers. The Jacksonville Jaguars at the Tennessee Titans. Those are the morning games. In the afternoon, we're looking at the Kansas City Chiefs at the Denver Broncos. If Denver wins, they will have a first round bye. Green Bay Packers at the Minnesota Vikings. If Green Bay wins, they have a first round bye. If Minnesota wins, they're in the playoffs. Minnesota needs to win that game to make the playoffs. The Miami Dolphins at the New England Patriots. New England needs to win that game and hope for a Denver loss to have a first round bye. The Oakland Raiders at the San Diego Chargers. The Seattle Seahawks hosting the St. Louis Rams. Seattle needs to win this game in order to make the playoffs. If they lose, they can still make the playoffs, but they would have to need help from other teams losing. The Arizona Cardinals at the San Francisco 49ers. If the 49ers win, they win the division. If they lose and Seattle wins the division. So there's a lot on the line. Plus, if they win and Green Bay loses, then they have a first-round bye. And then the game on Sunday night is the Dallas Cowboys at the Washington Redskins. If either team wins, they win a division. The team that loses will need help in order to get into the playoffs. So there's some bountiful games that's sitting out there, and even some of the games that are not playoff driven, there are some matchups there where there's some teams that really don't like each other. A great example is Tampa Bay and Atlanta. We know that Atlanta's in, but we also know that Tampa Bay hates Atlanta. And it's a divisional game. They've already seen each other a couple of times for the last 2-3 years. And we could see some wrinkles that we've never seen before out of either team. In this case, I think Atlanta may sit some of their players since they've already clinched their first round bye in the playoffs and the number one seed. So don't be surprised if Tampa Bay wins that game. The Jets and the Bills flat out can't stand each other. It's a team that plays in New Jersey that claims they're New York versus the only team that is in New York. So that should be
As a New Yorker, I could say thanks for bringing that up.
And also I want to point out that Sanchez is a starting quarterback with Tebow as a backup. Greg McElroy did not disclose the fact that he had a concussion, and he is being evaluated, and that's where that stands so far. So in the Baltimore-Cincinnati game, I don't know what's going to happen on either team. We know that they're both in the playoffs, but now the question is, if Cincinnati wins, they play Baltimore again in Baltimore. If they lose, they play either New England or Denver at New England or Denver. So I would rather play Baltimore if I was Cincinnati, I think.
Yeah.
Chicago and Detroit. Chicago just needs in. And oh, by the way, I wanted to bring up a stat. Did you know that we've been talking about Brandon Marshall and how much of a stud he is, Calvin Johnson beating Jerry Rice's single-season rushing record, Adrian Peterson almost up to 2,000 can possibly take out Eric Dickerson's rushing record. Did you know that Matt Stafford is honing in on a record as well?
What's that?
He is 350 yards away from being the only player in NFL history to go back-to-back 5,000-yard season.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, that's right, because Stafford hasn't been hurt the last 2 years. You're right on that.
I mean, that's just a hidden stat sitting out there that kind of threw me off a little bit when I saw that. I was going, are you kidding me? So here goes a guy who's on a horrible playing team. They have a lot of stars, and maybe the problem is their stars are all self-centered, but most of the stars are possibly self-centered, and that's the reason why they don't play well as a team. But we're looking at a guy who is actually getting ready to do something big, and his wide receiver could very well be the recipient of this to be the first wide receiver to receive for 2,000 yards, or for 1,000 yards.
Wow.
So this is huge because Calvin Johnson is already over 1,800, so he needs 100 and something to make it to that 2,000-yard mark, and Stafford needs 350. That could very well happen. So we could see something real big in Detroit.
So let me ask you then, from a fantasy football standpoint, is Matthew Stafford a first-round pick next year?
I'm going to go ahead and say possibly, but I will say it this way. I don't trust him staying healthy, even though he's gone 2-3 years without any hiccups. He's one of those guys that I would love to have on my team, but I just can't pull the trigger to bring him to it. Because just my luck, the year I bring him in is the year he goes down again.
That's how I look at it.
You know, now, barring anything that happened, I think it could be something special. I think it could be something special. So I think Matthew Stafford has quietly, and no one's talking about this thing on Matthew Stafford. And you don't hear much about people saying anything about Megatron getting 2,000 yards. So
I hear a lot about Adrian Peterson, though.
You hear all about Adrian Peterson, and we hear all about Peyton Manning. We don't even hear much about Russell Wilson, who's doing a fantastic job with Seattle.
Well, let me segue into that. I was going to ask you, who is your pick for Rookie of the Year this year?
I actually narrowed it down earlier, halfway through the season. I had it narrowed down to 5 people: Andrew Luck, Robert Griffin III, Russell Wilson, Doug Martin, and Trent Richardson.
Okay.
By week 10, I still had it at 5 because they were really going real well. Since week 10, I've dumped Trent Richardson and I've dumped Doug Martin because they towards the end of the season they kind of got weak. Which brings me to the three guys. So I said, okay, I would vote for the guy that ends up putting his team in the playoffs. Well, look at this now. Washington has been on a roll, and they've been winning game after game. Seattle's been doing the same thing. And Luck has already gotten his team in the playoffs. So the other two are pending victories today, which tells me now they all make the playoffs. Now who do I go with? Based on fantasy stats, I would have to vote for RG3 because he put up the best stats in fantasy football of the three of them.
Yeah, my pick was RG3 also, but this might sound strange, but if I had to pick the three in order, Andrew Luck would be my third best quarterback this year. I think Russell Wilson has impressed me enough to be legitimately considered as the number one quarterback. He may win it tomorrow for Rookie of the Year. He's that close to RG3, in my opinion.
If he wins tomorrow and San Francisco loses, I'm going to raise a serious eyebrow at the possibility of moving him up into that upper echelon of Rookie of the Year candidate. Because no one saw Seattle beating San Francisco for the division title.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, Seattle has a knockout defense, but this is not the Tebow-type scenario that we saw last year. So that's where I'm going with that. I'll tell you what. Let's bring up Rookie of the Year here in a second because I'm going to say right now RG3. I'm going to say RG3 right now.
Uh-huh.
Okay, now, which brings me to NFL MVP. Who do you think should be the MVP?
Adrian Peterson. No doubt.
I agree. I think if Adrian Peterson knocks on the 2,000-yard door, which he should be able to do, it, he needs less than 100 yards to do that.
No, he needs Adrian Peterson needs 208.
No, he needs that for the rushing
record.
Yeah,
Eric Dickerson, you're right. Okay.
But to get to 2,000, he doesn't need that much.
Right. But he's
so
banged up.
I understand, but you know we're also talking about the same guy that came back after 6 months from a year and a half. So he's not human. But if he makes it to 2,000 in a quarterback-driven league, I think he should be the hands-on MVP. Which brings me to the next segue, because Peyton Manning and Adrian Peterson would be the top two in this one as well, Comeback Player of the Year.
Right.
We're talking about a guy that had four neck surgeries versus a guy that shouldn't be playing yet. That's pretty, you know, Adrian Peterson hadn't had a surgery yet a year ago. He didn't get a surgery until the end of January. And then we're talking about Peyton Manning, who didn't even play last year because of four neck surgeries. So do we split them and give one and one the other, or does Adrian Peterson get both, or does Peyton Manning get both? This is going to be a wild race for both of these guys. But honestly, I think if he cracks 2,000, it would be bizarre if he didn't win the MVP. Because the league is already quarterback driven, so we already know the tie is like the offense and defense has the ball. We know the tie goes to the offense.
Mm-hmm.
So if we already know the tie goes to the quarterback because that's the way the league is driven, then for someone to become the fifth or sixth player to rush for 2,000 yards, that should be a given. But now let's say Calvin Johnson makes it to 2,000 yards. Should he be considered as MVP as well?
Well, I guess the difference being is that the Vikings were relevant this year and the Lions were not. I think that makes the bigger difference.
Okay. And I'm glad you said that, because if you would not have said that, then I would have said if we give Megatron the benefit of the doubt to be in contention for that same award, we have to also think about the only guy to go back-to-back 5,000 yards as well, which would be Stafford.
Right.
But here's the deal about the whole Stafford, Calvin Johnson. Yes, what they've done is incredible, but they both have each other. Do you think Calvin Johnson would be passing for 5,000 yards if he didn't have a person to pass it to, like Megatron? Or would Megatron have all those yards if he didn't have Matthew Stafford pass it to him, and vice versa? The good thing about what Adrian Peterson is doing is Christian Ponder is not carrying that offense. Adrian Peterson is. And in a two-back driven league, it's very interesting to see that this guy has basically led his team and is about to break the single-season rushing record, as well as for Peyton Manning, where I understand you have a killer defense, but, I mean, except for maybe Willis McGee on the offensive side, who else do you really have?
He has Demaryius Thomas, but they have to rely on each other, just like you said with Stafford and Megatron. So, based on your analogy, Cleveland Ray, I totally agree with you. I totally 100% agree with you. Hey, another game that kind of leaps out at me is the Philadelphia Eagles and the New York Giants. Michael Vick is starting. So now we have Michael Vick against Eli Manning, and we have an Eli Manning that is actually looking horrible the last 5-6 games of the season. This is a game that I think Michael Vick can win. It's like this is Andy Reid's last hurrah. Why not beat this division winner at their home. Now, everybody's blaming Eli Manning for a lot of the errors that's been going on and the foes that's going on. Mm-hmm. Eli Manning's not fumbling the ball like Wilson is. Ahmad Bradshaw's coughing it up like a drunken cheerleader. There's other factors that's going into this. One is their number three wide receiver can't stay healthy, be it Dominic Hickson, Reuben Randall. These guys are, they come in one game, they're hurt the next,
Hicks has been banged up all year.
Exactly. And now let's talk about the offensive line for the Giants. The offensive line for the Giants is completely blown away. So if that's the case, then, and I know that the quarterback, because of the quarterback-driven league, they have to bear the responsibility and blame. But I think a lot of people's putting too much responsibility and blame on Eli Manning and Tom Coughlin. And it's absurd that people even blame Tom Coughlin because he doesn't go out there and play. He's 70 years old. So I think Philadelphia actually can win this game. I just want to be to the point on that.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's the question. If Michael Vick comes back and has a killer game, yes, at this point in time, the Eagles are an outstanding. Goodness gracious. The Eagles right now, if they win, will be an outstanding 5-11 team. Now, if we see let's say we see the Eagles have a good game. Let's say we have Michael Vick rush for 50 yards, maybe throw two touchdown passes, has a good game. Does that mean that should we give him a second chance? Because it's not necessarily fair. We've been so hypercritical of him. He's gotten injured. And I'm not sure about you, but I can't really help if I hurt myself. And he's playing football in a sport where you most likely will always, have something that's banged up or something that's not always be at 100% max. So if we see them win the game, and if we see that maybe things start to click a little bit after 2 years ago, they claimed they were the super team, does this maybe give a chance for Andy Reid to quite possibly save his job and maybe Vic could continue to stay the quarterback in Philadelphia?
I don't think that's the case.
Falls time personally.
The one variable that is not brought up is the fact that Jeff Lurie, the owner of the Eagles, made it clear 8-8 is not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
So they've won 4 or 5 so far. So there's no way they're getting 8-8. So that's where I see this going. I think his tenure is done in Philadelphia, and the last 2 or 3 years have been very tumultuous in Philadelphia. And I honestly thought it started when they brought in Terrell Owens. That's when I saw the beginning of the end. And
Okay.
It's gotten consistently worse every year since then. And it was very controversial during. And it's really sad because, McNabb was the one that lobbied for Terrell Owens to give him a shot. Terrell Owens came in to be his buddy, and Terrell Owens is the one that caused McNabb's demise. But that's the way he is. He's a cancer.
By the way, while we're talking about McNabb, do you realize who has the longest current winning streak in the NFL right now?
The longest current?
The longest current winning streak in the NFL right now.
When you say longest current winning streak, I don't understand.
Who's won the most games in a row right now in the NFL? Like, as of right now, if we look at today, who's won the most games in a row? No. It's interestingly enough, the winning streak is not belong to the Broncos, interestingly enough. Well, yes, it does. Never mind. In second place, interestingly enough, is the Washington Redskins, who right now stand at 9-6, and their winning streak is an impressive 6 games.
Correct. Rick, I think the Denver Broncos is at 10 or 11 right now.
They're at 10. The Redskins are at 6.
Yeah. But, yeah, and I totally agree with you, Cleveland Ray. The Redskins have quietly put up win after win after win, come from behind after come behind after come from behind. And it's, again, it's the three rookies, the three rookie leading quarterbacks. You got Andrew Luck, who actually has reeled off, what, 6 or 7 come-from-behind fourth-quarter victories. We have RG3, even while injured, you know, not along with his Redskins, they're keeping them in the game and winning games. And it's not a 10-7 or 9-7 or 11-10 type game. We're talking about 27-24, 31-28. We're talking about some good, exciting games that's actually putting points on the board. And to me, that makes it more exciting than having a guy who can't throw a ball. And I hate to keep going back to the Tebow experience, but I don't have a choice. These guys are real quarterbacks. They know
how to throw the ball. Hey, you brought it up. So since I'm personally running out of time because I have a dinner to cook here in a little bit, I do think as bad as I know you're going to disagree with me, even though you haven't said it, I do think the Jets probably should have started Tebow this week just to shut everybody up. And they're not going anywhere anyway, and they paid a lot to bring him in. They should have at least let him start the last game and say, look, this is the reason why we didn't bring him in. And if he sucks in the first half, you bring in Sanchez.
Yeah, you're right. I do disagree. But the reason why there's a reason why I disagree. The main reason why I disagree is because of the fact that Rex Ryan has probably read the writing on the wall knowing that he's getting ready to leave, okay?
I don't know about that. I think he has at least one more year in him.
I don't think so.
I don't see him being that badly on the hot seat.
After
all the media hyped up the Jets to be with Tebow and Sanchez, and how are you going to have Sanchez lead the first half and then Tebow come back and put up miracles in the second half? Yeah, he's definitely not on the hot seat.
I think he's gone, and I'll tell you the reason why. His contract expires after this year. And there's going to be people out there where this owner is going to say that we got to move forward. Now, the owner was the one that wanted Tebow, not the coaches. Everybody keeps forgetting that. So the coaches had already been proven that Tebow's not the guy because they watched his audition in Denver. Denver played the Florida offense to make him somewhat successful, but it was the defense that kept them in the game.
But let me stop here and say Sanchez didn't look much better this year. I would say Sanchez might have been the worst starting quarterback in the league this year. So bringing in Tebow, to me, doesn't bring much difference. Sean Green, outside of a couple of games, has been a huge bust. Bilal Powell hasn't done enough to overtake Sean Green, and I was thinking Bilal Powell would have done a little bit more. There's been almost no receiving core after Santonio Holmes goes down. Jeremy Curley is okay, but if okay is your best wide receiver, I don't know. I think it's a fail all around on the offense. The defense is a top-10 defense. So I don't know. I think Rex Ryan has potential to stay another year or two, but the offense is so atrocious, I don't think they can do any worse than Tebow. As a matter of fact, if Tebow sucks, they can go back and justify Sanchez saying, okay, we have to bring more in.
Well, I actually have an answer for you for that.
All right.
Tebow was brought in to do the Wildcat. That's what the owner wanted. The coaches said no because it was going to become a media circus. Guess what? It became a media circus. And what people got to understand is that now that it's a media circus, now he's in the biggest, the largest media market, it's going to be amplified. What happened in Denver was the fact that people actually came to the games and right off the bat wanted Tebow, and that's all they heard for the whole 60 minutes of the game. Tebow, Tebow, the whole game. Denver realized that they were not going to go forward with Kyle Orton. So they brought in Tebow to show everybody that is not the right person. They did it intentionally with no expectations to win a playoff game or to make it and win the go into the playoffs. The problem is, at the time this happened, the AFC West was the absolute worst. The three teams behind Denver actually ended up in the top 10 in draft picks. So the timing was perfect for Tebow to take over this team. And even though everybody's talking about, well, he got them to a playoff game and they beat the Steelers, we got to keep in mind that they had a 9-7 record. It wasn't like they, you know, had a 10-3 record or 15-1 record or whatever you want to say. And people got to keep under, you have to understand that Mike Tomlin even said, I had no respect for Tebow throwing a pass, and he put 11 in a box, and Demaryius Thomas was the fastest guy on the field, and outran everybody. People have to understand that that's the reason why the coaches make the call. Everybody knows that Tebow wasn't the right guy from a coaching standpoint and from a player personnel standpoint. Woody Johnson just likes the guy. It has nothing to do with player personnel or talent. He likes the guy. He wanted to see him come in on plays like he did in Denver. Okay? To be honest, Jeremy Curley, in that last game where he played Tebow's spot, he was very successful with the doggone, the Wildcat. He was very successful. So if he was successful with it, what are we talking about? We're saying that Tebow is not as effective as Jeremy Curley, who is an okay wide receiver. So why are we talking about making him the starting quarterback? Because we brought him over there? Tebow, and the good thing for the Jets is Tebow has asked for a release after the end of the season. They can't let Sanchez go. If they keep Sanchez, they pay him $8.5 million or $8.75 million. If they let him go, $17 to $18 million is counted against him against the cap next year. So you're stuck with a guy that no one is going to pay $8 million for. So what do? You draft the quarterback. Start Sanchez, develop this guy, and switch him out. Kind of like what happened with Alex Smith and Colin Kaepernick. You let the kid grow, put it in games that you know that you're not going to win or that you know that you're going to win or you know that you're seriously going to lose. Put the kid out there. Let him develop some doggone experience. And then eventually after, you know, it could be the same year, it could be the following year, you decide, okay, bye, we're done with you, Sanchez. And, by the way, your contract is done. That's the best option.
Hey, in other related news, I just wanted to share that I finally won my first fantasy football championship this year. In our other league, I beat the New York Serial Killers. I guess that's a surprise, but I beat him in the finals to win my first ever. In my 14th try ever, I finally bring one home.
Mike, we are the champions.
Mike, Mike from Las Vegas, all I have to say is, I keep telling you this, Proof Negative has your number. Until you can show me that you can beat him, I will never, and I'm in the same division as him, as he in one league as well. Until he can prove that he can beat you, Proof, I'm always going to put him in the third slot. Or the fourth slot.
So I can escape the basement then.
Absolutely. Now, I wanted to give you some breaking news. The Saints and Sean Payton have agreed to terms on a 5-year deal to bring Sean Payton back to the New Orleans Saints. This happened about 2 hours and 17 minutes ago.
Yeah, I read that this morning. Actually, I think that's a decent move by the Saints. And the Cowboys are playing well enough, so Jason Garrett gets to keep his Yesem job.
Even if he didn't play well enough, who's going to come over there and let an owner tell him what to do?
I don't know. There's a lot of people standing in line. I'm sure Jerry Jones doesn't skimp when it comes to to paying someone to be a yes man.
The only way I see Jarrett leaving is under this scenario. Philadelphia fires Andy Reid. Andy Reid ends up taking over in San Diego, and North Turner moves to Dallas. That could actually happen because San Diego actually wants wants Andy Reid.
I don't think that's a bad move for them.
No. And North Turner used to play for Dallas, or used to be a coach, offensive coordinator for Dallas. So it's not like he doesn't know. What we're going to do now is we're going to go ahead and break away, and we're going to start our day off with some commercial breaks because we haven't had any yet, which was a little bit overdue, but we need to get those in. Proof, I'm going to yell at you after the show so that we can get together and put some things together. Cleveland Ray, as soon as I figure out on Proof's end what I need to do, I'll try to get you jingled in so that we can kind of do an ad or two together.
That would be absolutely fantastic. You know I would love to do that.
Cleveland Ray, let me just tell you before they go to break, download the program Audacity. It's a free program. Audacity, A-U-D-A-C-I-T-Y, Audacity, and we'll figure it out from there.
I appreciate that, Proof. Thank you very much.
You got it.
You know the Constitution like the back of your hand. You've read books, listened to podcasts, attended lectures, surfed websites, and watched videos. You've made liberty your life's goal, but something seems to be missing. Stickers from LibertyStickers.com. Exercise your freedom of speech with the world's most dangerous bumper stickers. That's LibertyStickers.com. But wait. There's more. You can buy Liberty stickers wholesale. Get them for 99 cents each when you put 100 or more in your shopping cart in any combination. Sell them or give them away. They're great for gun shows, flea markets, fairs, outreach, and more. Earn extra money, promote freedom, and spread the word. Need custom stickers, labels, or decals for your organization or business? Liberty Stickers makes them. Go to LibertyStickers.com to order or call 877-873-9626. LibertyStickers.com, the world's most dangerous stickers.
Antiwar.com is to promote anti-war activism, unlocking minds and shattering paradigms. By purchasing one of these t-shirts, you become an anti-war activist. www.antiwar.com, bringing peace and human rights to the mainstream. Buy it, wear it, become it. Anti-war tee.
This is Mercy. If you're listening to this message, warriors, you are the resistance. Warriors, you are not alone. There are pockets of resistance all around the planet. We are at the brink. Read about it in The Sovereign, newspaper of the resistance. Available now at newsstands everywhere. The Sovereign is a monthly 24-page tabloid newspaper featuring incendiary content about life during wartime in the age of Obama. Warriors, keep to date every month. Remember to read The Sovereign, newspaper of the resistance, available at newsstands everywhere. This alert is for all you boppers out there in the big city, all you street people with an ear for the action. This is Mercy. If you're listening to this message, warriors, you are the resistance. This is Mercy. Mine will be the last voice you will ever hear. Don't be alarmed.
In today's economy, the ability to access data quickly can mean the difference between success and failure. Maximum Archive's MyDrive service lets you have access to your data from just about any device and pretty much anywhere. MyDrive makes sure that when it counts, you can get what you need, because failure's not an option. Sign up for MyDrive today at MaximumArchive.com. Use partner code Freedomizer at checkout and help fund the Freedomizer Radio Network. That's MaximumArchive.com.
Welcome back. This is JC, and this is the Sports Lounge. Okay, some of the other topics that I want to bring up, I want to bring up some NBA, because we rarely do. the Stephen Jackson basketball player, he was fined for tweeting. And I'm going to ask Cleveland Ray later on what he thinks about this. This might be a good one for Ray's rants. Basically, what happened was San Antonio Spurs Stephen Jackson was fined $25,000 by the NBA for a hostile statement he sent to the Thunder's Serge Ibaka on his Twitter account. Ibaka got tangled up with Meta World Peace of the L.A. Lakers during a game, which earned both players technical fouls. Jackson took to Twitter to defend World Peace, a friend and former teammate. And what he said was, "Somebody tell Serge Ibaka he ain't about this life. Next time you run up on me, I'm going in his mouth. That's a promise. He doing too much," he tweeted. Jackson later deleted the message and apologized for his remarks. And he said, "I apologize to Serge Ibaka, the NBA, and to all my fans and for the comments I made," Jackson tweeted. "It was unprofessional and childish. I'm not a thug, just a man who speaks his mind. It was not appropriate. I do apologize. Only a man can admit when he's wrong." The recent public comments made by Stephen Jackson are absolutely unacceptable, cannot be tolerated, and do not reflect the standards held by the San Antonio Spurs, Spurs general manager R.C. Buford said in an email statement. The Associated Press had reported this. Jackson and World Peace, then known as Ron Artest, were teammates on the Indiana Pacers. Jackson infamously backed up World Peace during the Malice at the Palace in Detroit, which resulted in heavy suspensions for both players. Jackson had to sit out 30 games while World Peace was suspended for the entire 2004-2005 season. So this comes to no shock that Stephen Jackson would say something like this. And unfortunately, he's on a team that doesn't tolerate this type of behavior. Whether it's right or wrong or indifferent, that's just the way it is. It's not tolerated, and sometimes you have to think about the ramifications. It seems to me that he apologized for everything once he was fined $25,000. And now he's apologizing about what he said, because they've taken $25,000 out of his pocket. The good thing is the NBA actually took it serious enough to fine him a substantial amount of money. We'll see where it goes in the future, and hopefully for Stephen Jackson, he can ride off into the sunset without going through all the crap that he's going through today. Another thing that popped up was that Bobby Petrino, who is who actually recently left the University of Arkansas as the head coach because of extramarital affairs and so forth. He was just signed to be the head coach of the Western Kentucky Hilltoppers. And he'll be in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and he's back in the coaching ranks, and he wants to make the most of his second chance. Petrino was introduced as the Western Kentucky new head football coach. He was fired in last April by the University of Arkansas for a pattern of misleading behavior following an accident in which the coach was injured while riding a motorcycle with his mistress as a passenger. So he hopes it can be as long as possible. He had a 34-17 record at Arkansas before he was dismissed in the wake of a scandal. Petrino had an affair with a former Razorback volleyball player, who he later hired as a football assistant and gave $20,000 in gifts. He said initially he was the only person on a motorcycle, but later admitted to her presence. He said he wasn't going to be able to sit down with his mom and dad and a student athlete and make them understand how this experience has made him a better coach. He said he is going to be able to, I'm sorry, and a better person that will make him understand their son better. Petrino said that he's also looking forward to the opportunity that he'll be able to give student athletes when they make a mistake as well. So Petrino is actually stepping up to the plate, it appears, and we'll see where it goes. When everything goes down in the long run, yes, I think Petrino should be given a second chance. A lot of people don't think that way. Cleveland Ray, what do you think if you're there?
Well, I do appreciate that. I am back, and I did not get to hear the whole story because I actually just arrived back. So
the story I was actually giving up there was about Bobby Petrino being hired by the Western Kentucky Hilltoppers as a head football coach because of his – he was fired at Arkansas for he got into a motorcycle accident. And he had his mistress on a motorcycle, and he lied and said he was the only one on it. Come to find out that she was on the motorcycle with him. He gave her a $75,000-$80,000 a year job for being part of the coaching staff. He bought her $20,000 in gifts, and he was trying to conceal it. Then when it all leaked out, they ended up dismissing him from the team. And now he's at Western Kentucky, and he's saying that he's glad that he finally got an opportunity to get a second chance. Do you think this is viable?
No, it doesn't, because if you're an idiot once, most likely, unfortunately, as sad as I am to say, most people will not change, and they will continue to be the same way. So, number one, you got to keep in mind, he's not going to be necessarily in the spotlight as much as he was with a big-time, you know, with the big-time team that he was with Arkansas. Now he's going to be in Western Kentucky in a small town where he could probably get away with a lot more things and not be under national scrutiny necessarily as much as if he was in Arkansas. So I'll be fair. We'll give him a shot because everybody deserves two chances because we're not human. We're not perfect. But I say if he screws up with this Western Kentucky Hilltop job, then I think that's about it for him.
I agree. I totally agree with you, and that's exactly what I said. I think he should be given a second chance because we all make mistakes in this world, and a person's actions should be based on the person's actions, not based on how we feel about the situation. And in this case, I commend them for giving him the opportunity, Western Kentucky for giving him an opportunity to come back and try to prove himself, and it's a good thing. I think it's going to be a good thing for both him, his family, and the NCAA because he is a very successful coach. He was very successful at Louisville. He was successful at Arkansas. As I mentioned earlier, he won 34 games at Arkansas and lost 17. So he was getting that team in the right direction to be part of the SEC big picture. And now he's at Western Kentucky, where I'll give him about three years, and he'll have Western Kentucky, one of the top teams in that conference as well. Hey, Cleveland Ray, are you ready for your rant?
A rant? If you give me just a little bit longer, I can most likely be able to do my rant here in a little bit, and it will involve the NBA, but in a way you've probably never heard before. Cleveland Ray's rant. Stick around. You won't want to miss it. You want to do maybe one of these weird stories?
Yes.
We don't have a name for them yet, but they're definitely stories you do not hear on the mothership or on NBC Sports. Should we do one of those?
Yes. Which one would you like to go to first?
Well, let's start out with candy. I think everybody likes some nice candy in their lives, except the Czar Mike Fratello definitely got a very, in my opinion, an interesting Christmas present. The Inside the NBA host swapped holiday gifts at the end of about a week ago's NBA showing, with a special gift to the show's staff from longtime coach and analyst Mike the Czar Fratello. It was a large chocolate bar with the Czar's moniker on it. So he basically now has his own chocolate bar that you can actually go on and look online. It says the Czar in huge words. It looks like the Z is probably about as big as my head. And then with Mike Fratello under it. But, yeah, he got a candy bar. He got his own candy bar for Christmas. I wish I would have gotten me one of those. That candy bar looks about as tasty to me as eating Marv Albert's wig, so I will stay away from eating that bar. But
what I did was I also posted the link to show that candy bar at the freedomizerradio.com chat room area so that people can get a look at it.
It is a big bar. Go big or go home. What about Kenneth Faried? Should we talk about how the Manimal topped off his big game the other night?
Yes.
So about a week ago, Kenneth Faried played in 29 minutes against Denver's win against San Antonio, posted 19 points, 11 rebounds. But according to the Denver Post, Faried, unfortunately, was sick with a cold and flu. Okay, more impressive that he put up those good numbers while being sick. He sat the final 7 minutes of the third quarter before re-entering at the start of the fourth. But just 3 minutes later, his illness caught up with him during a timeout. The Nuggets television radio network caught the moment for the rest of us, including how quickly Kosta Kupis and Ty Lawson were to get away from Faried as possible. He vomited while on the bench, resting up so that way he could come back in. He vomited right next to his teammates Kosta the Doofus Kupis and Ty Lawson. So I guarantee you that's something you definitely did not hear about on any of the ESPN shows.
Correct. I think that is funny. I think it's funny, but at the same time, I feel for the guy because that's very embarrassing at the same time.
He's only 22, you know. You know, we'll give. Let's see if he does something embarrassing. You know, he's not necessarily posting stupid tweets like Steven Jackson is. You know what I'm saying?
That is true.
Did you talk about the Steven Jackson story already?
I surely did, right before I brought you back.
All right. Well, then, never mind. Cleveland Rays rant, we will do that coming up here in a little bit, but I will tell you, we'll be about the Clippers and why the winning streak might not reach the magical number of 33. It definitely, you'll stick around, you'll definitely want to hear it. It's definitely, what you'll hear is definitely not necessarily how everybody else in the world will break it down.
Okay, but, and what I'll do is I'll go ahead and go to a station break right quick to give you a little bit more time, so that we can get some of our fellow sponsors piped in on that.
In today's economy, the ability to access data quickly can mean the difference between success and failure. Maximum Archive's MyDrive service lets you have access to your data from just about any device and pretty much anywhere. MyDrive makes sure that when it counts, you can get what you need, because failure is not an option. Sign up for MyDrive today at MaximumArchive.com. Use partner code Freedomizer at checkout and help fund the Freedomizer Radio Network. That's MaximumArchive.com.
We are so pleased to announce ESP Botanicals is now sponsoring Freedomizer Radio. They have a bath and body line of products made for keeping your skin beautiful and healthy, but it's also for psoriasis, eczema, rosacea, and dermatitis treatment. They are meticulously prepared skincare products made from the best botanicals available. Committed to buying only from the growers when they can and using the highest quality cold-pressed oils, botanical organic additives, the best steam-expressed essential oils, and the least processed carrier oils that are available in today's marketplace. Pamper yourself or someone special in your life. Give the gift of beautiful, glowing skin. ESPBotanicals.com. Thank you so much for supporting us at Freedomizer Radio.
Hello, everyone. Proof here again. I want to let you know about our brand new sponsor, Silver Leaf Tea. Now, as you guys know that have listened to me for years, I am a tea aficionado. I have hundreds of different flavors and styles at my house. And Silver Leaf has exactly the kind of stuff that I look for. I love loose tea, great antioxidants. I just love the taste of it. And this Silver Leaf has black, they have green, they have white, they have organic. Great for hot tea and iced tea. Silver Leaf Tea, it's right on our website, freedomizerradio.com. And check it out and order it. Silver Leaf Tea.
Okay, welcome back. This is JC, and along with me is Cleveland Ray. Okay, Cleveland Ray, you have it. You actually have the floor. Go ahead and let's go ahead and get started on Ray's rant.
So, ladies and gentlemen, as of right now, we have stepped, in the first time in NBA history, there has actually been a record that is set. Now, for those of you that don't know, there is this new rating system called the plus-minus rating. Now, there is, for the first time ever, there are two starting lineups from the same team that are in the top five. Now, the best plus-minus rating team, the Grizzlies, with the lineup of Gasol, Conley, Gay, Allen, and Randolph. The second best plus-minus rating starting five are Lance Stephenson, Paul George, George Hill, Roy Hibbert, and David West of your Indiana Pacers. Third are the 76ers starting lineup. But interestingly enough, the sixth man team and the starting lineup of the Clippers are both the fourth and fifth best lineups according to plus-minus rating. Now, the reason why I say that is because right now the NBA Clippers have tied 17th place all-time as of last night for the most with the most wins in a row at 16. They're in 17th place. They have some interesting upcoming games that definitely will test this record. They need 16 games to win. And of the 16 games they have left, there is only two games with teams under. Of the 16 games left, there's only four teams with a sub-500 record that they will be going against. Those teams will be Washington on the 19th of January, Phoenix on the 24th of January, and then Portland on back-to-back the 26th and 27th of January. But look, the rest of the teams they will be going against, even tonight they will go against Utah, who they had a 19-point come-from-behind win. Denver, Golden State, Los Angeles, the L.A. Lakers, Golden State, Dallas, Orlando's another sub-500 team I forgot to throw in there, Memphis, Houston, Minnesota, Golden State again, Oklahoma City, and the only good thing is, like I said, the final two games that will decide if they win 33 games are the final two Portland games. Will they be able to do it? Absolutely not. Now, the reason why I say that is because, number one, they play a lot of back-to-back games. In fact, as of right now, me looking, there's at least five back-to-back games already in the month of January. So we'll definitely test the durability of the players. Now, the only good thing that I will say and what makes them so exciting to watch is they have depth at every position. Their depth has depth. Obviously, you have players like Chauncey Billups, Caron Butler, Blake Griffin, DeAndre Jordan starting, and Chris Paul, obviously, the all-star, maybe even, dare I say, former future Hall of Famer. But look who you have coming off the bench. You have the defensive stalwart in Matt Barnes, Chauncey Billups, Eric Bledsoe, Jamal Crawford, Grant Hill, Lamar Odom, who's gained 50 pounds, but he definitely adds some depth to that front court, as well as Ronnie Turioff, who's a defensive standout from France. So, interestingly enough, this team to me is built a lot like the 80s teams were, where they have a lot of depth, a lot of good players, which will help them benefit because, you know, if you're playing back-to-back games and Chris Paul can't play every minute, you still have the choice of a young, athletic Eric Bledsoe or definitely a little general in Chauncey Billups who could definitely lead the team. But the only downfall I can really see them having, it's not their depth. It's not who they're going against because the Clippers are a great team right now. But it's their coach. I think Vinny Del Negro could, unfortunately, easily get out-coached. I know Clippers fans are saying boo right now. Unfortunately, he probably can't get out-coached against some of the players like Scott Brooks of Oklahoma City, definitely George Karl. He almost got out-coached by Tyrone Corbin last night, but somehow he was able to pull a miraculous 19-point come-from-behind win. Now, I hate to jinx it, but you almost lost to the Utah Jazz, who, yeah, they're good, but they're a young team in depth, and they do have some depth in the front court, but their back court, you have basically the upper advantage on the back court. They only have maybe two or three good players on the back court, a la Gordon Hayward or Mo Williams. Maybe you could put Jamal Tinsley in there, but Jamal Tinsley hasn't been good since the early 2000s. So it's kind of scary. Maybe I don't think they will do it. They have definitely a rough schedule coming up, a lot of back-to-back games. They even have two back-to-back games within the span of a week. So we'll definitely test them, and they'll definitely see another thing that the Clippers have not done. How will they do in the spotlight? The Clippers have been a joke even since their Buffalo days. They're even their San Diego days. They've just been a joke. They've had good players but had to ship them off. If you have a good season, if you break this 33-win record, which I don't think you will, how will the team react? Will the team become cocky? Will the team become arrogant? Will for 1 year the team in L.A. not be the Lakers? I don't know. But obviously the Lakers are having their own turmoil this year, while the Clippers have had great success. Because like the Lakers in past, one of the main things the Lakers do not have is depth. One of the main reasons why they were back-to-back champions is because of the Lamar Odom, Pau Gasol matchup. Because even if Andrew Bynum was being a nutcase and doing all sorts of crazy stuff, you still had Lamar Odom to come and then play 30 minutes a game. Who Lamar Odom could also back up as a small forward, so he could even take some time from meta world peace a la Ron Artest. Will they be able to do it? In this person's eyes, absolutely not. But maybe in some hopeful fan's eyes who thinks the NBA is finally getting back on track when you have a team like the Clippers, who's maybe built of a couple all-stars, but a lot of them are homegrown or just good players who are having nice team chemistry. But if there will only be one downfall of this team, it's how well Vinny Del Negro can outcoach the coaches of like Rick Carlisle in Dallas. This has been Ray's Rant. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, there, Cleveland Ray. That was actually a good story. I like that. And I am going to go ahead and jump on the bandwagon and say that the Clippers do not break that record. It's a tough record to break, number one. Number two, how long has that record stood, Cleveland Ray?
Well, first off, the 33-game win record what took place of the Los Angeles Lakers of the 1971-72 season, they didn't even win 70 games that season. They went 69-13. But the closest any team has come to the Los Angeles Lakers was obviously in the 07-08 season where you had McGrady, Yao Ming on the Houston Rockets, and they only won 20, and I say only, but they won 22 in a row. Now, you got to keep in mind, the Lakers won 33 games in a row, but they had Jerry West, Elgin Baylor, and probably one of the greatest NBA center of all time in Wilt Chamberlain. So can the Clippers really compete with a starting three like that? Yes, I said in the past the Clippers had some nice players coming off the bench, but when you have three Hall of Famers that play 40 minutes a game like the Lakers did, it's tough. So best of luck to you, Clippers. If you do break it, mazel tov, congratulations. But, I mean, can you really do better than the Chicago Bulls, who won 17 in a row? The Boston Celtics in the 80s, who won 18 in a row? The Boston Celtics of the 2008-2009 season, who won 19 in a row? You know, the Los Angeles Lakers, who won 19 in a row, when they had, obviously, two Hall of Famers in Shaquille O'Neal and Kobe Bryant, and obviously a nice starting power forward in Vlade Divac.
That's a very valid statement. And that's what makes it tough, because the back-to-backs are not easy to do. The back-to-backs are not easy to do at all. Very, very tough to do. Hey, what we want to do is we want to go ahead and move towards some of the fantasy leagues I want to bring up. Just want to pipe in the winners and keep it moving from there. In fantasy play, the champion of the Dynasty Extreme League, which is called DXL, I want to congratulate Mark from Oregon with the Seattle Hellcats winning back-to-back and third title since the league's existence. This league was formed in 2005, and the Seattle Hellcats is the most decorated team in the league. And congratulations, Mark. In Primetime Dynasty, known as PTD, I want to congratulate Matt from Minnesota with the Minneapolis Maniacs. It was well-deserved. It was a very good game, and congratulations to Matt. In Extreme Dynasty League, known as XDL, I want to congratulate Jared from Utah with the Utah Lollygaggers. And also in Blazing Aces Dynasty, known as BAD, I want to congratulate Jared from Utah with the San Diego Lollygaggers for winning both titles. So Jared has had a coveted year this year by winning in two separate leagues. in Red Zone Blitz. I want to congratulate James from Missouri with his St. Louis Hammerheads on winning that title in RZB. And in TBL 2, I want to congratulate Rob and Mike from Pennsylvania with their nappy-headed hoes for winning the title in TBL 2.
That's a really good name that they have, by the way.
It is. It's one of those leagues where you can kind of use any name. Most of the leagues that I'm in, you have to use city and mascot name. But that particular league is actually pretty funny.
Just like I'm a big fantasy baseball and I'm a big fantasy basketball guy. I mean, I'll play fantasy football. But I think in all of fantasy football history, I think you have the most killer logo. Just saying.
You mean the one that I sent over to you?
Yeah, the beautiful,
the New York Eradicators.
Yes, with the interesting logo idea of the ship firing a gun. Very interesting,
yes.
Very unique idea, and I like it because you're going out of, you know, a lot of people choose the ballers or the all stars, but you chose an interesting name. One, a name that I even had to Google to see even what it meant, as well as an interesting logo on the side that definitely screams, hey, look out, we're going to beat you.
That's exactly what I was going for. That's exactly what I was going for. So what we're going to have to do in the future is get you into one of these free fantasy leagues so that you can get a taste of what it feels like to get smoked by the Eradicators, Cleveland, right?
I think I will smoke the Eradicators with my beautiful team called the San Diego Stupids or the Indianapolis Idiots.
We'll find out. Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to segue over into NCAA football. There's a couple of things that I want to bring up there. Earlier in the year in college football at the University of Wisconsin, five guys saw this black kid that was walking down the street. He was leaving the library and he was heading back to his dorm. Well, they jumped on the kid and he ended up with a head concussion. So he was actually in a situation where he was out of football for the first two games. I think the one game, or he missed part of a game or something like that. But come to find out, the kid that they ended up beating up was the starting running back by the name of Monty Ball at their college.
Wow,
one of the things, isn't that bizarre?
That's what we like to say here in Cleveland as a bonehead move.
Exactly. So what ended up happening is one of the individuals ended up saying something to the point that if we would have known he was our football player, we would not have beaten him up. That's how the law enforcement, the authorities ended up finding out who the people were, because the person made an even bigger bonehead move by making such a statement and it getting around the school. This is what this kid said.
Kids these days, you can't love them, but you can't necessarily think they're idiots.
So what now has happened is that they found that two of the kids were found guilty of these charges. And I find it, the attackers actually ended up pleading guilty on their own accord. And in Madison, Wisconsin, two of the three men accused of assaulting the running back this past summer pleaded guilty to battery charges, but both were given a chance to avoid prison. One kid is 21, the other one is 22, and they pled guilty to substantial battery, which is a felony that carries a maximum penalty of 18 months in prison. But instead of imposing a prison sentence, the judge placed them in a first offenders program.
You know what the judge should have done? You know what the judge should have most definitely done?
What's that?
He should have sentenced them to be tackle dummies for their college team. That would definitely be some punishment right there.
I agree. I totally agree. It's bizarre. It has a very, very strange twist, but it's really bizarre that this has happened. And to go on further, she says, this gives you an opportunity to get the support and services you need to avoid coming back to the criminal justice system, she told both men. The judge didn't detail the terms, but such programs generally last about a year and mandate that defendants meet requirements such as going to a class, paying restitution, doing community service, and getting needed treatment. If the requirements aren't met, the defendant can be resentenced.
Nice.
So, and here we go with this second chance thing again. Now, suppose they would have really messed this kid up. We're talking about a guy who is going to, he was at the beginning of the season, one of the top two running back talents that the NFL were looking for. Because this past year he took a step back in from his previous 3 years in the NFL, he's now looking at a possible third or fourth round pick. So it may have something to do with his psyche or his playing ability, because a lot of people were even saying that early on that he ended up with a concussion from the kicking to the head and stuff like that. Do you think these guys should do you think the sentence was too light, or do you think it was on point, or do you think it was too harsh?
With something like this, it's very, very tough, because kids will be kids and kids will be idiots. Do I think it's fair that they cost this guy possibly his chance at being an NFL star? I mean, granted, a third or fourth round pick is fairly impressive, but if you're telling me that this guy could have even had the potential to be a first-round pick?
A late first, early second.
It's not necessarily fair, but look, there's been players that have done stupid stuff, and they pay for it. I really do hate to say this example, but look at the Len Bias. His friends told him to do cocaine, and look what happened. Dude never played a game in the NBA, because the one time he did it, he unfortunately passed away. He died because of a drug overdose or something involving his heart. But kids will be kids, and kids will do stupid stuff. If this kid's really as good as he will say, then that player will definitely be a steal in the third or fourth round.
That's the way I look at it, too.
But the punishment, I definitely think, was jail time. Now, if you could help me out here, what exactly happened to – now, what were the injuries that were caused to the player from these two gentlemen?
Head trauma, head concussion. They beat him up, and when he ended up on the ground, they started kicking him, of which two of them ended up kicking him in the head.
Okay.
Now, we don't know how many times he got kicked.
I understand that. I mean, I hate to sound yes and no. I understand the head's a very important part of the body. Without it, we'd be dead. But at the same time, it's not like as if he broke his legs and he can't walk again, although I do realize to some people that that is just as bad. The punishment could have been a little bit tougher, but kids will be kids and kids will be idiots. Those people will definitely, believe you me, I guarantee you, those two people that beat up that running back are definitely getting an earful and an eyeful from some of those other people there at that college, probably even the player's family. So karma's a pain in the butt, and it'll come back to bite them. Those kids, at least.
I agree. I totally agree. And then to move forward, there was a kid in college football a couple of years ago by the name of Terrell Pryor at Ohio State. He was in a situation where there was controversy there because of some things that he was doing. He ended up going into the NFL. He's on the Oakland Raiders team. And it looks like he's going to get his first opportunity tomorrow to start for the Oakland Raiders at quarterback. So hopefully this kid has turned around. And personally, I don't care for him as a quarterback in the NFL. I really didn't think he was that good. He may turn out to be the answer that the Raiders need. I have no idea. But I wish him well in the NFL.
Although I do not respect him as a person and a man of character, I do wish him the best as well.
Hey, the, along with that particular scenario, did you know that the New York Knicks tried to trade Amari Stoudemire?
What? That's ridiculous. Who would do that? I mean, why would you trade Amari Stoudemire? He's only missed 60 games so far in the 2 years that he's been there. About a week ago, Howard Beck of the New York Times wrote of the impending return of Amari Stoudemire to the New York Knicks. Most of the story is about the problems that Beck foresees coming along with Stoudemire's return, but buried underneath all this information is this tidbit. This past summer, the Knicks offered Stoudemire to nearly every team in the league, available for free, as one executive put it. Though they found no takers because of his diminished production, his health, and his contract, which has 3 years, $65 million remaining, including this season, and which is uninsured against a career-ending knee injury. In February, the Knicks wanted to send Stoudemire to Toronto in a deal for Andre Bargnani, a person briefed on a discussion, they said. But the proposal was vetoed by James Dolan, the Garden chairman, before it ever reached the Raptors, who would have made the deal anyway, the team's officials say. Well, not even the Toronto Raptors wanted this guy. The proposed Bargnani trade sounds less embarrassing than it trades actually less embarrassing than it sounds, as Bargnani was having a decent year before the All-Star break last season. But available for free as recently as this summer? That's pretty cold, but not the kind that's going to make a Stoudemire's return to the Knicks any easier. I mean, goodness sake, he's playing in New York. Stoudemire said that he'd be open to coming off the bench when he returns, but it's hard to be a team player while also feeling unwanted. So enjoy the renaissance while it lasts, Knicks fans. Things can get ugly very, very quickly.
It's a long day when this happens. It's very hard to say. I can't fathom them trading him either. But I do know this: the team actually plays better when either Stoudemire or Anthony is out of the game, or both. They actually do play better. Now, since Carmelo Anthony has come back and Stoudemire's been out, they've been playing very well. But I just can't see them letting this guy go.
But here's the thing: Sorry to interrupt. But
it's okay.
The thing is, too, is that's what weren't they saying this a couple years ago, that it was a renaissance in New York with Raymond Felton and Amari Stoudemire? Then why did you need another soup in the kitchen? There were too many cooks in the kitchen when you brought in Anthony. All it was star power. Believe you me, it was definitely a nice core group of two small forwards and Wilson Chandler and Danilo Gallinari, who, by the way, hit a career-high 7 3-pointers in a win where he scored 39 points the other night, might I add, so he turned out to be a very good player. I think what the Knicks had before, they had one star guy and a bunch of nice players, was really working out nicely for them. But I guess they were just too hard-headed and said, no, we need that other star player. I didn't think Amari was the answer. I didn't think Carmelo was the answer. I think there's too much selfishness in that locker room, and the players are full of themselves. You know, kind of like they'd be the kind of people, I believe, that if they're in a room and nobody recognizes them, that they would say at the top of their lungs who they are.
I agree.
Too many soups in the kitchen. Whether you trade away Amari or whether you trade away Carmelo, you definitely have some nice front court defense in Iman Shumpert. So I'm not sure what you're really going to upgrade on. You have a former defensive player of the year in Tyson Chandler. So what are you going to do if you're the Knicks? What do you want in return that won't be expensive? I'm not saying that a 3-year, $25 million contract is by no means expensive, But what do you want in return? You really wanted Andre Bargnani, who's going to average 4 rebounds a game? Iman Shumpert, his rookie year, for about a stretch, averaged 5 or 6 rebounds a game, and he was a shooting guard and was 6'4", not 7 foot tall.
I could not have said it better. And I just find it fascinating that they would even let this leak into the media that this is what was going to be that they were trying to do. Maybe it's the right thing. Maybe it's not. Another big step backwards, I thought, in NCAA, Texas A&M, we always listen to what everything surrounding Texas A&M, we always hear about Johnny Football and Johnny Heisman, talking about Johnny Manziel, who won the Heisman Trophy this season. There was another freshman that was on Texas A&M, but he was one of the top wide receivers on the team. He was the number 33 player overall. He was ranked number 33 overall. And he was the nation's number three receiver when he was signed by Texas A&M. He decided after the Heisman was given to Manziel, for some odd reason, he is now going to quit Texas A&M.
Is he going anywhere else, or is he just quitting football in general?
What happened was he withdrew from the school with no one's knowledge, and he disappeared for like 2 days. People were trying to find him because afterwards his withdrawal came up, and they were going, wait a minute, this is our football player, so they're looking for him, couldn't find him. Well, they found him in his hometown in Dallas, and he had returned home to his family, and he was trying to sort things out for his future. So that's the ongoing process right now, and they think he's trying to decide where he is, if he's coming back, if he comes back next semester, if he's going to take the year off, or if he's going to transfer. In conversations with the kid, he's just trying to figure out what his next step is. Now, he was one of their top wide receivers. I mean, he actually made a couple of big catches in the Alabama upset. So for this to happen at the time it happened, I think it set back Texas A&M going into that bowl game against Oklahoma in the Cotton Bowl. So this is, you know, I thought it was going to be tough enough to play Oklahoma, but to take this guy, you know, take this firepower out of your lineup and now try to redevelop the next person in line, it's going to be tough.
Now, here's what my question. Now, I'm sorry, but is it ridiculous that the players are so full of themselves that these players think that they need to be the star, they need to be the best, whatever? I consider it appalling and ridiculous. But
Cleveland Ray, before you, I don't mean to cut you off, but before you say that, no one really knows why. Some people are saying that he was homesick. Some people are saying there's other reports that came out that said that the reason why he left was because he was homesick.
Okay,
so,
well, that's fair, but I'm just saying that if it's for the reason why we think it is, then that's pretty sad. I understand it's not the reason why, or it could easily not be the reason why, or could easily be the reason why.
Okay.
But regardless of the reason, if the reason is because that he wants to be that star player, because no offense, it's fairly ironic when your freshman teammate wins the Heisman Trophy that you just disappear. I mean, it's ironic timing. If for whatever reason, you know, a person in your family got really hurt, or your girlfriend was having problems back in Dallas and you wanted to move back, I understand that.
Right, but
just the way and the ironic timing, and if he really is upset about it, upset about not necessarily being considered the top player, then that's pretty sad, because it shows you how selfish us human beings can really be. As a freshman, you're starting, you can't be happy for your own teammate who had a great season, set an NCAA passing record, and you can't be happy enough for him. You got to be so self-centered that you got to go out and you got to go disappear back to Dallas without saying anything.
Makes sense. But until we know why he left we have to, it's all speculation. Until we know why he left, it's all speculation. So it could be for a selfish reason. It could be for a personal reason that has not come out yet. And trust me, if there's something out there, it's going to come out, because until he makes his decision and the reason why, it's, you know, the media will eventually come up with the reason why. So another one that's out there, and I hate to go back to this story, because this story has been bleeding all over us, basically for the entire year, for the most part, and that's the Penn State debacle. There's a situation.
Yeah.
I just posted at the FreedomizerRadio.com chat room. Penn State University requested to delay McQuarrie, the kid that whistleblowed on Jerry Sandusky. Penn State tried to delay his lawsuit because what they wanted to do is to get the rest of Jerry Sandusky's crap out of the way, so that they can prove without a shadow of a doubt that they had the school itself had nothing to do with this. But the bottom line is, from a whistleblower standpoint, it's not what you didn't do, it's what you did. And in this case, Sandusky, McQuarrie was dismissed because he told on Sandusky, and Joe Pa, being a representative of the school, is the one that gave the marching order. And the athletic director and president, they all agreed and let it happen, because they could have overrode him, but they didn't. Whether they feared what Joe Pa would do is irrelevant. The bottom line, from an HR standpoint, it was the wrong thing to do. So this kid now had filed a lawsuit, and they were trying to get it to back off until they could prove more on Sandusky to roll it into Sandusky. Well, the courts announced that it's not going to be delayed. I thought that was a great thing. This Pennsylvania judge denied Penn State's request to hold a former assistant football coach Mike McQuarrie's whistleblower and defamation lawsuit until related criminal cases are resolved. Judge Thomas Gavin is the pending criminals matter. He said the pending criminal matters impose no burden on Penn State because the university is neither a prosecutor nor defendant in the cases against the former administrators Graham Spanier, Tim Curley, and Gary Schultz, because they're no longer employees of Penn State. So that's the technicality that he's using to allow this case to move forward. McQuarrie, who testified in June that he complained to the then head coach Joe Paterno after seeing defensive coordinator Jerry Sandusky naked in the shower with a boy, is pursuing a civil suit against the school. Gavin and Spanier, Curley and Schultz, have no Fifth Amendment right to refuse to testify, nor need they fear that information gathered in the case can be used against them in the criminal proceedings, because this is where McQuarrie is going against the college for not giving him the support from an HR standpoint. What do you think? Do you think this is a good thing or a bad thing?
I think just this whole thing in general, first off, delaying the case is stupid, because what it's showing is that the school's still trying to cover up its own derriere. It's still trying to cover up its own problems, that maybe there are still some skeletons in the closet, and some of them do know about it, and they went through with it, and they're just making sure they cleaned up all the stuff. That's what I think. Sandusky, Penn State debacle, it's just sickening. It's sickening that Joe Pa knew. It's sickening that this went on. It's not like this went on for, it's not like this happened two times. This went on for basically since 1997 or 1998. I was only 2 years old, and it went till I was 16. That's a span of 14 years where little boys were meeting Uncle Jerry in the shower. That's sick.
Well, I agree. what we're going to do is we're going to, and I
oh, not, oh, oh, not you, Uncle Jerry, but Uncle Jerry Sandusky.
I understood what you said. I was just messing with you there. What we're going to do is we're going to segue over to commercial break, and we'll be back for more of the Sports Lounge.
I am an autonomous government agent here to steal your livelihood. Not so fast. I'm Sovereign Filing Solutions.
And I'm the Sovereign. We're teamed up
to bring you
the truth without censorship.
Are you tired of being fed multi-million-dollar media lies?
Are you ready for the real story?
Sovereign Filing Solutions has teamed up with the Sovereign Newspaper to make sure you get it.
And not the BS this guy behind me wants to feed you.
Take the step, help make the change.
Oh, come on, that's not even fair. How are we supposed to rule indiscriminately if you know what's going on?
We are so pleased to announce ESP Botanicals is now sponsoring Freedomizer Radio. They have a bath and body line of products made for keeping your skin beautiful and healthy, but it's also for psoriasis, eczema, rosacea, and dermatitis treatment. They are meticulously prepared skincare products made from the best botanicals available. Committed to buying only from the growers when they can and using the highest quality cold-pressed oils, botanical organic additives, the best steam-expressed essential oils, and the least processed carrier oils that are available in today's marketplace. Pamper yourself or someone special in your life. Give the gift of beautiful, glowing skin. ESPBotanicals.com. Thank you so much for supporting us at Freedomizer Radio.
Hello again, Freedomist. Proof is here, and I want to talk to you about a brand new soda maker called SodaStream. Now, the Proof House has had SodaStream for about a year, and we love the thing. We use it quite often. With SodaStream, you can have fresh-made soda in seconds. One of the big things we like about it is that there's no high-fructose corn syrup and no aspartame. There's over 60 flavors, or you can create your own. Not just sodas, they also have iced teas and energy drinks. Here at the Proof House, we make egg cream sodas all the time. Some other facts to consider here, there's no electricity, no more wasted bottles and cans, and the most important thing is that it tastes great. Keep in mind, too, this is a perfect family present for Christmas, or, hey, just surprise the family with something great. Also, for a limited time, there's free shipping, so go to FreedomizerRadio.com and look for the SodaStream link, and I hope you check out the product. That's SodaStream right on Freedomizer Radio.
Oh, yeah, baby. Do you know what time it is? It's time to get your freak on. With your host, Max Casey, right here on the Black Market Liberty Show, Fridays, 6:30 Central.
Hey there, Freedomizers. This is JC from the Sports Lounge. Join us for 3 hours on Saturdays as we take a break from politics to discuss sports at FreedomizerRadio.com. Come and join us each Saturday from 9 a.m. to noon Pacific, noon to 3 p.m. Eastern.
Greetings, this is Blake the Eccentric, and I want to invite you to check out my new show on Freedomizer Radio, The Eccentric Perspective. It's sort of a red pill, blue pill, going down the rabbit hole kind of show, featuring outside-the-box politics, philosophy, and gonzo journalism. But be warned, with knowledge comes responsibility, and you might not see the world the same way again, as I will attempt to open your mind, speak to your common sense, and challenge your critical thinking skills. So please join me Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday from noon to 1:30 Pacific Time. Once again, that's Eccentric Perspective, only on Freedomizer Radio.
Welcome back. This is JC and the Sports Lounge. With me today is Cleveland Ray. What we're going to do is we're going to go to a developing story that's been sitting out there. It's going back and forth, and that is the wonderful world in the NCAA called the Big East. And what we have in the Big East Conference is teams have been leaving the Big East. They've lost quite a few teams. For example, Big East teams the Big East team, the Big East has 12 teams set to play football in 2013, but faced major departures this year. One was with Rutgers going to the Big Ten, and Notre Dame and Louisville, Notre Dame basketball and other sports, Notre Dame sports minus football, plus Louisville is leaving for the ACC. Now, in addition to that, the Catholic Seven has also left, which is the non-seven, the conference's seven non-football teams. They have now announced that they will be splitting the Big East. So we're talking about Georgetown and St. John's and Seton Hall and so forth, Marquette. All these teams are moving on to form their own conference for basketball. And now the Big East had mentioned that they're trying to go after Temple, but Temple was initially listed as dismissed from the league. What I'm finding out is that that Temple, I think, turned them down. I'm not sure. It doesn't matter to me one way or the other, but it didn't work out. So what happened was the Big East now said, well, let's go someplace else and find some team. So they found San Diego State and Boise State, and they found TCU. TCU, as this was formulating and teams were coming and going out of the Big East, TCU says, you know what? We're just going to go in the Big 12. Most of the teams that are in the Big 12 are closest to us from a traveling scenario, and it made more sense for them to go to the Big 12. The Big East then found that while the Big East was arguing over that the TCU, even though they never made it to the Big East officially and played any games in the Big East, they were trying to figure out how much money they can get out of TCU. While all that was going on, West Virginia opted out, and they went to the Big 12 as well. So they lost West Virginia in the middle of all this chaos. Well, San Diego State and Boise State now is saying, hey, because the Mountain West Conference just redid their CBS sports package where the teams are basically going to get the same amount of money as the Big East or more, and that the conference is a lot more, they're figuring that the conference is a lot more competitive than the Big East, and the fact that the NCAA did not make the Big East part of the big package when it goes into the playoff scenario because of poor play in the past in football with the Big East. The Mountain West actually have been in situations where they've been stronger than the Big East. So now Boise State, even though the Big East is looking at Fresno State and UNLV to possibly come into the Big East, Fresno State, UNLV, with the possibility of Boise State coming back, and BYU talking to the Mountain West about going back into the Mountain West. The Mountain West may end up in a situation where they get San Diego State back as well. Because as Boise State goes, so goes San Diego State possibly. And San Diego State made it clear that they don't want to be the only one on the West Coast that's going back and forth to the East Coast. So we're looking at a Mountain West conference that may end up turning out to be a viable conference that is not part of the big boy, but yet it could be one of the first conferences to get recognition outside of them. So I find it fascinating that with all this craziness going on with the Big East, we are finding ourselves in a situation where the Big East is not going to still be viable from a football standpoint. And they just lost their basketball programs that are the top programs in front of Big East. So I don't know what to say about this. How about you there, Cleveland, right?
It's just, as we're looking now at the NCAA football in general, we're seeing that there are these convergences of super conferences. And I think by the time I have children, we will have three big super conferences. I think it will be the Big Ten, the Pac-10, and then the SEC. I think somehow, some way, kind of like how there's only two kind of like for baseball, there's like the National League and the American League. There's two different ways. There's two big different conferences. That's what I think will happen with the NFL, the NCAA. And obviously with all this controversy with teams leaving certain places, like with the Christian Seven and all that stuff, I think it's just a matter of time before we have these super conferences, which I think when we do have these super conferences, we need a playoff system, which I am going to be very glad. I have never been a big college football guy because of the whole BCS bowl system. It made my head hurt when I was younger trying to figure out who would be where. But if you just have a playoff, that makes it nice and easy and nice and convenient.
Okay. And that I find it a little troublesome because what we're looking at right now is as much as the Big East is trying to make themselves viable, there's got to be something else going on there that is telling teams to move on, and I have no idea what it is, and I'm just guessing. Is it possible that the reason why this is happening is because of the fact that every team is getting an equal share, even though there are seven teams that don't get football endorsement, even though there are seven teams that don't have a football program? Is it possible that they're getting an equal share and people are saying, well, that's not fair? And then looking at it from the other side, maybe that has become a line of discussion where the non-football programs are saying, you know what? Because you want to go back to the other, you don't want to give us an equal share. We're just going to go ahead and become a different conference, and that way you guys can have all your cake and eat it too, and we'll go and get us another cake. Do you think that's possible?
I think so, because obviously, as you've seen in the past, the SEC has kind of had a renaissance where you have it being interesting, where obviously they haven't been relevant, but you had teams like Auburn and Alabama and LSU fighting for the title every year that you saw they're making massive amounts of money. And because they're making massive amounts of money and because that they had all these players, you know, other conferences like, hey, you know, I want a bigger chunk of that money. You know, just like a couple of years ago, but the Butler Bulldogs this is a great example. The Butler Bulldogs went to two back-to-back NCAA championship games. Granted, though, they lost, and they should have won one of them with that Gordon Hayward shot.
I agree.
They went on to go to the Big East, I want to say, for basketball.
They're no longer
in the Horizon League anymore, which is a little dinky league, and they saw that there was greener pastures in another league to make more money with a more talented conference. So
they actually decided to stay in the Horizon League, if I'm not mistaken. I'm looking it up right now. But I think
Go ahead and look that up and double check me. But the point is that some of the, like Boise State, for example, there's all these teams that are looking for greener pastures, and they are just these greener pastures where there's gonna be more money and more football talent and more money for their college, and to get out, you know, kids that come to their college to spend $50,000 a year just to buy some books, you know. So there's a lot of advantages to being a super college when you have sports, but, you know, no offense, the MACs, the Mountain West conferences, the Horizon Leagues of the world, how long until, you know, some of those teams, if they even have a remote chance of being good or have a remote chance of having high-class talent, how long until they, you know, skadoosh out of their little small conferences and join into the big ones?
That's true.
I think it's really true. We're seeing that happen in basketball. You talk about Hawaii. I want to say a team. Hawaii joined the Big East or got invited to join the Big East. What the heck is that about?
That's the Big East desperate for you. So you have to have 12 teams to have a conference playoff. That's where the big money's at. If you have less than 12, you can't have a conference playoff.
And now we're gonna have these conferences of 20, dare I even say 30 teams competing. And I think it'll be interesting. I think it'll make it more so, but I think it's not fair to the smaller colleges the less talented colleges who don't have a chance of winning. That's all.
Well, they've made it clear that at least there's going to be 5 mega conferences so far. They already made that clear. It's a possibility that there will be a 6th one. And it looks like, based on what the Mountain West and Conference USA is doing, what they've done is they've aligned with one another, and there's going to be a new name for both conferences. Or they may end up keeping the same names, but then they're going to have a Mountain West Conference USA championship. So where to be the winner of the Mountain West and the winner of the Conference USA, they need each other for the championship to represent both conferences in a bowl game.
That's I like that idea. Because, no offense, I'm getting sick and tired of the Beef O'Brady, Comcast Digital, Kraft's fight for Hunger Bowls. I'm sorry, but, you know, we don't need... I kind of liked it back in the day. Obviously, might have been a little bit before my time, when we had, like, the Cotton Bowl, the Sugar Bowl, the National Championship, you know, just like the main 4 or 5 or even 6 bowls. You know, we don't need... The Pepsi Bowl, you know, like think of a small company, the Dinty Moore Bowl.
I don't have a problem with those bowl names, and all that is somebody sponsoring something. What I don't like is a team that has 6 wins and 6 losses, knowing that if they lose, first of all, why are you bowl eligible with 6 wins? To me, it should be 7.
To make money. It.
I know that. I knew the answer. I just was being sarcastic. But
okay.
So I think there should be 7, because if you are at 6-6 and you lose, you now have a losing record. So why did you go to a bowl game and end up with a losing record? Why, if you're 7-5 and you lose, you're 7-6. That's my point. And at least you still had a winning record going. The other thing is, you were right about Butler. Butler left the Horizon League, and they went to the Atlantic 10 Conference. And the Atlantic 10 Conference actually has 2 teams, including Butler, that are ranked in the top 25 in the nation. So that's a good thing.
Who's the other team that's ranked in the top 25?
Hold on for a sec. I take that back. They're not ranked in the top 25. They're sitting outside. That'd be Temple. Temple knocked off, at the time, number 3 ranked Syracuse last week. So their stock has risen. They're overall number 27. I was looking at my list, because my list goes to the top 100 that I do myself. But they're number 27. They're not in the top 25. But Butler is actually ranked number 18 in the nation right now, and they play today, by the way. But Butler moved over to the Atlantic 10 Conference, which includes Charlotte, University of Charlotte, Butler, Temple, LaSalle, Dayton. The Dayton Friars are in that conference as well. St. Louis University. Oh, by the way, who was the head coach at St. Louis? He was he just died right before the season started. He was a coach at the University of Utah in the Mountain West Conference. I can't think of his name off the top of my head. It'll come to me here very shortly. But I really like that guy as a head coach. He's a top-notch guy, and we need more coaches like him.
Rick Majerus.
Rick Majerus. There you go. It's really sad that he died. I thought he was one of the top-caliber overall head coaches we've had in the NCAA. And I really took it bad when I found out that he had died.
The other thing, too, is no offense to the Atlantic 10, I respect their conference, but the only 2 really big draws you have are Temple, who, I mean, haven't really been, they've made some NCAA tournaments, but they haven't really been as dominant as they once were, and Butler, you know, kind of came out of nowhere, and now they kind of became the media darlings for a while, and now, you know, they lost. They obviously had a lottery pick in Gordon Hayward.
Right.
So, I mean, there's only 2 big draws there. If you look at a team like the Pac-10 or Pac-12 or Pac-23 or whatever number they are this week, you have teams like UCLA, you have teams like USC, you have teams like Oregon, Utah, Arizona. You have all these historically great teams, and even UCLA, even without Shabazz, they haven't even been as good as they once were thought to be, at least coming into this season.
They were ranked at the beginning of the season. UCLA was. The problem
where are they
is
now?
They were,
I would love to know where they are now. They're definitely. It's definitely no longer their Jordan
Formark
love Darren Collison days. I'll tell you that.
They're in the top 30. Oh, by the way, they knocked off number 8 Missouri last night, 97-94 in overtime. Shabazz Muhammad played in his third game because he didn't play in like the first 9 games, and he had 27 points last night en route to knocking off Missouri. That was it was a well played game, but
free Shabazz.
So he's a local talent here in Las Vegas. Went to high school here in Las Vegas, and everybody knew that he was going to University of Kentucky. His last three choices was University of Kentucky, University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and UCLA, and he chose UCLA. And I think he did because he wanted not to play in Las Vegas because this is where he's from, but UCLA was the closer of the three, of the two remaining.
Can you imagine those who played for UNLV? How awesome that would be. Maybe even Jerry Tarkanian would come out of retirement to coach for a single year.
Actually, Jerry Tarkanian's assistant is doing very well right now, Dave Rice, and the team is 11-1. They played at North Carolina tonight, this afternoon, and they're ranked number 20 in the nation.
Let's go Rebels!
It's an interesting game, and we'll see how it pans out. The good thing about it is that we're looking at a team that beat North Carolina last year. So we'll see how it goes. And Bullock, who is one of the top, his name is Reggie Bullock, the forward for North Carolina, he has a concussion, and he will not be playing against UNLV today. So.
What's the guy's name from Kentucky? He's the freshman. He's got like the flat top haircut. He's got a really unique name.
Oh, gosh, what is his name? And Kentucky's not doing as good as they did in years past. But, again, what do you expect from a team that boasts a lot of freshmen every year? Exactly. That's where it gets hot and hairy.
What is that guy's name? I can't even.
I'm trying to remember his name.
Like an S, maybe?
I'll tell you here in a sec. I'm looking it up as we speak. But what were you going to say about him?
No, I just think it's interesting because I thought the dude had an awesome haircut, and everybody was saying at the beginning of the season how he could easily be the player of the year, and I haven't heard anything about him since.
That's right. You're absolutely right. The guy that you're talking about is Nerlens Noel.
That's right, the New Orleans, Nerlens. No offense, but how do you think of that name, you know? It's no apple or it's no pineapple, but Nerlens?
Yeah, Nerlens Noel. He's from Everett, Massachusetts.
Isn't he only like 18 or 17 years old or something?
Let me see the flat top here. Yep, this is the guy. He was born in 1994.
Wow. So he's 18 years old.
Yeah.
That flat top, though, definitely makes him look older because that's definitely a 90s cut right there.
You say 90s. I might have to go back into the 80s because I remember when Will Smith used to sport that.
In West Philadelphia, born and raised, is the day I used to spend most of my days some relaxing with a couple of guys who were up to no good. Started causing trouble in the neighborhood. Got into one little fight. My mom got scared. Said, "Moving with your auntie and uncle into Bel Air." Dun 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 dun.
So what do you think about Boise State talking about moving back?
Dun, dun. Where are they moving to? I didn't realize they left. They left. They're not in Boise anymore. Where they moved to? Snake River?
The big. No, they were talking about moving to. The Big East.
Oh, because that's so smart to be in Idaho and be in the Big East. Genius. Obviously they'll be able to see that they can make more money and continue winning that conference, but that also says something else, too, about Boise, is that they don't think because no offense, they're playing in kind of a not the best conference in the universe. I understand they've gone undefeated. I understand they had Kellen Moore. I understand they had Doug Martin. But to have the chance to move up and the chance that you complain that you aren't in higher bowl games, but the chance to join obviously a conference that's far away, but still a better conference than whatever one you're in, you know, that says a lot about the team that, you know, you talk a lot of talk, but when it comes to walking the walk, you're kind of like the puppy in the corner with his tail between his legs.
Makes sense to me.
Speaking of puppies in the corner with their legs, what about Andrew Jones?
I saw that article. What do you think about that?
Well, obviously, it's unfortunate that if quite possibly a 10-time gold glover, guy who hit over 400 home runs, was only 70 hits away from 2,000 hits, could quite easily be one of the biggest snubs at the Hall of Fame ever, was arrested on battery charges. That's right. My story comes from CBS Sports. Dateline Duluth, Georgia. Former St. Louis Stars center fielder Andrew Jones was freed on bond after being arrested in suburban Atlanta early Tuesday on battery charges, according to jail records. Around 1:30 a.m. Tuesday, police responded to a call for domestic dispute between Jones and his wife in Duluth. Gwinnett County Detention Center records say Jones was booked in the county jail around 3:45 a.m. and was released on a $2,400 bond by 11 a.m. the next morning. Once the premier player of the big leagues, Jones broke into the majors with the Atlanta Braves in 96 and won 10 consecutive gold gloves from 1998 to 2007 as their center fielder. He has 434 career home runs over a span of 17 seasons in the majors. Jones earlier this month signed a $3.5 million one-year contract with the Tohoku Rattian Golden Eagles of Japan Pacific League. So it'll be interesting to see what the Japanese think of him getting arrested, because welcome to most American athletes nowadays.
But
this is the surprising part about it. How much of an idiot he is, you know?
I agree. But the other part is, it looks like it happened.
If you love someone, you don't have a dispute between them.
I agree.
Or, I guess, a physical dispute or whatever they claim this is such a big deal. A domestic dispute. There we go.
There you go. But he's lucky it happened in the United States, because you do that stuff in other countries, their laws apply, not ours. So
yeah, so imagine you did that in Japan.
Yeah, it could be ugly. They only have two.
You could
have
turned into some sushi.
Yeah. Another one is that's really sad in baseball is Ryan Friel was found dead in his Florida home. Apparently of a suicide. They said it was a self-inflicted shotgun wound, and the medical examiner will make a final determination on the cause of death. A lot of people are saying he was a great teammate. He spent six of his eight seasons with the Cincinnati Reds and finished his career in 2009 with a .268 batting average, 143 steals. So a lot of people are really stunned that this happened, and he leaves behind a wife and a child. I just find it really odd that these things are happening a lot these days with athletes in all sports, for the most part, are doing stuff like this. And maybe it's the pain that they're playing through and the fact that the attention that they were getting was so immense that they can't get past it. I don't know. What do you think, Steve?
Who's Steve?
There's more going on here than meets the eye, obviously. I mean, look at the kid who shot himself in front of the Kansas City GM and head coach. So, I mean, this kid was a rising star. He was an up-and-coming young player doing well. So something has got to be going on in today's sports that's causing these young guys to bring themselves to the point where they feel killing themselves is the best answer.
I agree. And Cleveland Way.
I blame the Jersey Shore.
Yeah, and then we can go back to Junior Seau, Dave Diedrich, Dave Dierdorf. I mean, these are just recent ones. I'm not going to say it's out of control, because this is something that you can never say that's out of control, but it's really really painful to hear about these. Such thing.
And to have these, you can kind of understand the football side of things, where these guys had suffered head traumas and multiple head traumas over seasons, and them not doing much about it in the past because there just wasn't a lot of information. There wasn't a lot of research going on. Now there is. On the baseball side of things, these guys aren't getting hit like they are on the football side. So you wonder, what is it that's driving the guys in other sports who aren't suffering the kind of injuries that they are in a game like football?
Hockey is getting a lot of these too, by the way, just to let you know that. It's really bizarre, though. Overall, it's bizarre.
It really is.
Okay, there was an article that I wanted to bring up that I just mounted over at the freedomizerradio.com. It's called Athletes Are Going Hungry Now. NCAA is buckling down on these athletes as far as what they pay for food and so such things. And basically what has come to the forefront is about some of the coaches in basketball and football are saying that these players can burn about 2,500 calories per practice when they go to practices in all the different sports, and that it costs quite a bit of money. And when I say quite a bit, from a school standpoint, I'm talking that's a lot of money. From an individual standpoint, what has happened is, a great example, Boise State, Kentucky, Boise State football, Kentucky basketball, UNLV baseball and basketball are some of the entities where the NCAA was considering giving them bans because of the fact that the school paid for someone's lunch so that they can have money. I mean, not money, but food, because the amount of money that they're getting from a scholarship standpoint or the scholarship scenario that they're getting is not enough food based on the amount of calories they're burning in one and two practices per day. I find it appalling that the NCAA is looking, you know, like, for example, with the soda pops at Boise State, they were looking at giving them a two-year ban. But then we have the Penn State debacle, the Ohio State thing with Terrell Pryor and coach, I forgot the head coach at the time that was there before, Urban Meyer.
Jim Tressel, the greatest man to ever wear a sweater.
Yeah, the greatest liar. And the other, and then the University of Miami getting caught for recruiting violations for the second time when they should have got a death penalty. These things are still permeating, and they're trying to brush them underneath the carpet so that they can get out of the limelight. But we want to take a school that gave, you know, where they had something there where this company was funding all these people that came there for free and giving everybody six packs of soda pop, and then they had extras left over and they just said, hey, you guys take them, and the kids took them, and then they wanted to ban them for 2 years for taking a six pack of soda pop home. But yet here goes a guy that's been abusing kids. And we have the double recruiting violation, and then we have the Ohio State debacle. And even though Penn State is getting 4 years of no scholarship, why are they playing football? Nothing personal. I don't have anything against Penn State, but I have an issue with the sanctions not being fair. How do you compare two cans or six cans of soda pop to someone maliciously doing something to little kids? How do you make this situation outweigh the other one? There's only one answer: the amount of money that school could produce to give to the NCAA versus the other one. That's the issue. It's money. But I just wanted to get that off my chest. It just bothers me.
That was Jerry's rant.
That was. And we're looking at a situation now where the NCAA now, because of a lot of people taking notice of this, now they're forced to take another spin at what they're looking at, as you know, as far as how much kids should get versus today's prices. Because it's not, you know, the amount of equity that a kid gets out of everything is zilch compared to how much the schools make and the NCAA makes off of these kids performing.
Mm-hmm. Now, can I throw in my half a penny, Jerry?
Go for it.
Okay. I think it's fairly ridiculous that these people that for years, I'm one of the advocates that's saying you don't pay these players $50,000, but you give them enough money where they can go live a normal life of a high school student, go see a movie, go on a date with your girlfriend, go to a football game with your buddies, you know. You don't have to give these players $50,000. Now, that being said, the fact that you claim you're so money-stricken when you're making, what, millions of dollars per game that you get on NBC or ESPN, that you can't feed your own kids or you have to cut back on what they're eating because you think that's so much money, that makes me wonder, where is these millions of dollars going you make every game that you're doing it? Does that mean that they have something going on in the side where they have to be paying off these bills? I mean,
How about this? I can tell you where some of the money is going. There's, as we know, there's chancellors at each university, correct? Or excuse me, there's athletic directors at each university, one of which becomes a chancellor that represents that conference, correct?
Correct.
So that person is getting paid to be the athletic director for the university. Then they're getting paid to be the chancellor for that conference. And guess what? On the football side, the chancellors are also the ones that make that form the BCS. So they get paid three times. They have three salaries. But that's okay. It's okay because they're the ones making the rule.
But don't you think that's ridiculous that these players are burning basically the average human body is allowed to eat 2,000 calories a day. That's what's considered a healthy diet. The fact that these players are burning that and an extra 500 calories – why, this is like starving a racehorse. Why would you starve the thing that's going to make you money? And why has there not been, you know, more of an outroar? I mean, I understand food, you don't want to make a big deal about it, but without food, you would go hungry. So it's fairly ridiculous, and it's fairly sad that these players are willing to shell out millions of dollars for a coach, but not an extra $25 for a bucket of chicken.
Exactly. And just to add to that, swimming doesn't bring in quite the money that a lot of these other sports we're talking about, but we know from a practice standpoint, swimmers burn more calories than most of the sports.
Oh, yeah, and listen, although I don't think swimming's fun to watch, I support it because I think it's the right behind wrestling, I think it's one of the most difficult sports to do. But again, it's just, I mean, they use that debate that, oh, you know, the money we get from our football and basketball programs are the thing that funds, you know, the women's travel volleyball team. Well, that's fine, except for the fact if you go to a women's volleyball game, they're playing in the same jerseys they've had for 25 years. Or you can obviously tell they haven't been taken care of as well as they should. You know what I mean? So,
correct.
And now there's, you know, obviously, like I said, they're pulling out, you know, no more mashed potatoes. You know, it's just ridiculous, and there's greediness, and it's not about the kids anymore. It's about the wellness of the college. Even though those players are there for 1 year, you can say whatever. Look at Anthony Davis. Look at how much money he brought in with the unibrow, you know, with that T-shirt, and, you know, how he was five blocks a game and 16 points and 12 rebounds and 4 assists, and he brought in all that stuff. And you can't get him an extra piece of chicken? How dare you, NCAA? How dare you?
Another great example that hits home here in Las Vegas is the fact that he was an NBA player and he was on the UNLV National Championship team under Jerry Tarkanian.
Johnson?
Help me out. No, not Larry Johnson, the point guard. He played for the New York Knicks.
Sprewell?
No, three
Starks.
Yards is not from Las Vegas. Nope, you got to go backwards. What is his name? He's an ESPN correspondent right now. Steve, help me out.
I know who you're talking about, but I don't remember his name. I'm sorry.
But anyway, he had a T-shirt company that's well known today, and the NCAA said because he owned that T-shirt company, they were going to suspend him for 1 year because he was making money on his own.
Oh my goodness! Are you flipping kidding me,
Greg?
Greg Anthony.
Greg Anthony.
The lefty
point guard.
Yeah, and he ended up selling his T-shirt company to his mom for a buck so that he can play for UNLV.
And yet the NCAA supports a BCS that is one of the most corrupt systems outside of politics today. So it makes you wonder, what exactly is their agenda and why is it that it's okay to make money off the backs of kids, but allow them to go hungry, in a sense. I mean, they're not going hungry, literally. But these kids are burning up calories left and right. And as in school, if you're hungry, you're not going to pay attention. You're not going to learn.
And here's the other thing, too, that do you realize that the NCAA is a non-for-profit organization? Which means none of that money is taxed, which means none of that money is going to the government, which means all the money is feeding to the NCAA and all the little pricks who want their money. The NCAA needs to have – by the way, the only thing in sports I think that's more corrupt is the NBA lottery. I hate to break it to you, but the NBA lottery is pretty rigged. They need to have a nice cleansing like baseball did in the mid-2000s. They got rid of all these steroid players. They need to have a cleansing. They need to get rid of the people. They need to get rid of any of this. They need to have their money taxed. They need to be more fair to colleges. They need to be – I know I'm saying basically a utopia for running a business, but I understand there's no such thing as a utopia. But if you
well,
claim –
Well, it's not
that,
a business. This is not a business, though. This is a corrupt organization with a monopoly. So it's a very different situation versus running a business, especially considering that they have a not-for-profit type of organization. But it is for profit. It's for profit for an elite few who basically rides the backs of these people that bring in the money for them. And they're not protecting the players. They're not protecting the personnel that are responsible for bringing forward all of these great things in sports. And so we have a misallocation of resources, and we have a corrupt few who is monopolizing sports today, especially at the college level. And it's got to go.
Which is why I thought the USFL back in the day was a fantastic idea, because now you're having somebody who comes up and challenges the way things have been. Granted, the courts were idiots and thought that they were only after money and only gave them, what, a $10 check or something like that? A $10 check in damages? And obviously the USFL went under. I'm not sure if we had another conference that comes up more fair, you know, even pays the players, like, what, $500, you know, just every now and again so they can live a normal college life and not spend 5 hours a day, you know, practicing and on top of homework, on top of schoolwork, on top of, you know, all that stuff, sleeping. I don't know how these players sleep, for dang sure. Maybe there's a sleep gate. Not only is there a food problem, but maybe we need to start giving these players at least, you know, an 8-hour rest a night, you know. Have that rule implied. I don't see that. But instead, they're not worried about the players. They're worried about, oh, you got a 6-pack of Coke because there's leftovers? You're going to get a 2-year suspension, Boise State. It's
that
sad.
Was stupid.
And why don't what?
That was stupid for the NCAA to even be considering investigating something like that. And let's get somebody out there right away, because this is, oh my God, look, the world is going to end if we don't do something about this. But yet, those other three scenarios, the Penn State one, it ended up running through another system called the federal courts because of the damaging aspects of it. But the other two is basically an NCAA choice to sanction or not to sanction, and they look the other way because they're bringing in too much money to for us to penalize them. And that's where we got to get away from. That's exactly what we got to get away from.
My last
and yet they, and they also protect coaches who bring in the most money. I think there's a coach running around now who has been sanctioned four times in the last 5 years.
Don Calipari. Not in the last 5 years. Not in the last 5 years. But he started at Providence College. Providence got in a little trouble, and he basically jumped the ship and went over to the University of Massachusetts. And after 2-3 years, he ended up with recruiting violations because of Marcus Camby. There was a recruiting violation on how he ended up with Marcus Camby. UMass got sanctioned for 2 or 3 years, and he ended up at Memphis State, which is now University of Memphis. And there was a recruiting violation on Derrick Rose, and the university got smoked by NCAA sanctions, and he ended up getting rewarded at the University of Kentucky. And I think if the school gets sanctioned, the coach should also get sanctioned.
Yep.
Because the coach does not get – I mean, when I say sanctioned, if you give Memphis State 3 years where they can't be in a bowl game, then that coach should get 3 years to either stay at that school and deal with that bowl game issue, or you can't coach for 3 years anyplace else. You cause the problem, you deal with the problem. I think they should have – if the school wants to stay with him, fine, but that way he suffers along with the school. But if the guy decides to jump ship and goes elsewhere, he should be in a situation where he can't jump ship.
That's not going to happen. He brings in too much money for the NCAA as a whole.
Here's the other thing, too. I will bring this back up, and this is the last thing I'll say about controversies, at least in my brain of thought. The Terrell Pryor thing, even if you really think about it, it's not that – I understand he lied, but it's not that big of a deal in retrospect. The dude,
when you say he lied, what are you saying?
The dude, again, he had no money. He doesn't have time for a job. He wasn't smart. You know, Greg Anthony, smart. He had a business opportunity. By the way, doesn't the NCAA say that they're students first, then athletes? They shove that down our throat that they're always students first, then athletes second. But somehow, when a player is running a T-shirt company, which is good because he's learning economics, and maybe, hey, if basketball doesn't work out, I can go into business management. I'm so confused as why the NCAA would not support that. But back to my Terrell Pryor point, they obviously are being worked so hard and all being worked to a point that they don't even have money to do basic things like, okay, get a tattoo, great, a lot of college kids do it. And if you want to trade, you know, your jersey, that's not the college's. You know, it's your jersey. There's a reason why the word your is in there. If it's the college's jersey, if it's the NCAA's jersey, it's the NCAA's jersey. But no, you own it. You wear it every given Saturday, and you work, and you put in the time and effort. And the fact that they are just thinking of an excuse to make money, like, you know, Ohio State's been a good team this year. Jerseys? Jerseys and tattoos.
It's a little bit more than that. He also ended up with a new car every year. The jersey he was trying to sell, he ended up giving it to the guy because there was $10,000 worth of tattoo bills sitting out there. So the jersey equivalence was like 10 grand. There's a little bit more. I mean, to me, that resonates in my head. And that's the reason why I say, okay, if you're not going to let a guy eat, you're not going to allow the guy to have an extra $25 or $50 to eat, then Terrell Pryor's situation should be bigger than it really is.
You know, the other thing, last thing I'll say, when the Reggie Bush accident happened, I'm not sure about you guys, but I didn't hear about it as much as I do Sodagate in Boise State or Tattoo Gate in Ohio State. I didn't hear nearly as much about that from USC as I did those other schools.
But the reason why is because an alumni gave Reggie Bush's parents a favor, not Reggie Bush. Reggie Bush's parents ended up benefiting out of the deal because they got a brand new house. Reggie Bush, per se, he benefits because his family got a new house, but it wasn't directly given to Reggie Bush.
But don't you think it's much he had to give up his Heisman Trophy, though?
Well, that was brought along because if you really notice how things go with the NCAA, usually the schools that's west of the Mississippi get the hardest sanctions. SMU, UNLV, the incident with Boise State being blown out of proportion versus the three teams that's on the three colleges that's on the east side of the United States. Southern Cal got smoked, but guess what? In the
UCLA with the Shabazz accident.
Correct. And that because somebody made three more phone calls, but guess what? The guy that ratted out UCLA for Shabazz is the same guy that we're talking about that has recruiting violations. So I don't get it. He got mad
if
because
one person
they,
goes down, everybody else has to be brought down with it, it seems.
Well, he, basically what he's saying is, if I can't get my way, then I'm going to tell on everybody. But yet he knows he's the chosen one. What I would like to do at this stage is I would like for Cleveland Ray to go ahead and talk to us about this former racehorse who is retiring to a quiet life of painting.
Yeah, Metro was once a racehorse who won more than $300,000 in prize money at tracks like Saratoga and Belmont, obviously tracks that have a lot of historical significance. But these days, unfortunately, he had to retire because he had bad knees, but now he spends his days, he got adopted, and now he lives in Rocky Ridge, Maryland, eating hay, and also he dabbles in painting in abstract paintings. Ron Kajorski of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, adopted Metro along with his wife Wendy, is an artist. The Wendy's an artist herself. Ron tells WHP-TV of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, that he noticed how much Metro would bob his head up and down after the horse came off the track. So Ron decided to stick a brush in Metro's mouth and put a canvas mounted on the asshole in front of him. Once Metro grasped how to hold the brush, he was all about it. Quote, "As you can see," Ron tells WHP, "how impatient he gets when he doesn't have a brush. In the months since he's developed his hobby, Metro has produced a number of paintings that have sold from anywhere to $40 to $300. And the proceeds are going to help benefit adopted horses or former racehorses that are going to be adopted." So that's a great story right there.
I thought it was pretty interesting. Because you don't hear much about horse racing, number one, especially on the show. But it's ironic that this horse actually is in a situation where it's something to talk about, and he's doing canvases, and they're actually making good money off of it.
He is going to a good cause. Take that, NCAA.
Exactly right. What we're going to do is we're going to go to a station break, and then we're going to come back with a version of True or False, and this is where I would like to get your inputs on some True or False statements that I've submitted over to you guys earlier in the week, and we'll see where it goes. I'm quite interested in hearing your responses.
Hey guys, Proof here. Guess what? I just got a cell phone. Hey, for everyone that knows me, I'm not a fan of cell phones, but I just signed up with a company called Solovay. And Solovay is offering a plan right now with unlimited phone, text, and web for only $49 a month. Plus, if you refer a friend or two, you get a discounted rate for everyone you refer for as long as they have Solovay, not just for the first month, but for the whole time that person has Solovay. You sign up enough people, and Solovay pays you every month. What other cell phone company is going to pay you for service? Anyway, go to Solovay.com/freedomizer. That's Solovay, Solavei.com/freedomizer. Learn all about it. Plus, and another kicker, if you sign up three people under you, you'll get another month for free as well. Plus, they're going to pay you cash. Anyway, Solovay.com/freedomizer.
Hey there, Freedomizers. This is JC from the Sports Lounge.
Join us for 3 hours on Saturdays as we take a break from politics to discuss sports at freedomizerradio.com. Come and join us each Saturday from 9 a.m. to noon Pacific, noon to 3 p.m. Eastern. Hey there, Freedomizers. This is JC from the Sports Lounge. Join us for 3 hours on Saturdays as we take a break from politics to discuss sports at freedomizerradio.com. Come and join us each Saturday from 9 a.m. to noon Pacific, noon to 3 p.m. Eastern.
Hey, Freedomists, join me, Proof Negative. Weeknights, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Pacific, as we fight the New World Order together, right here on Freedomizer Radio, your exclusive home of the Proof Negative Show.
This is Debbie.
And I'm Michael, along with CD, the Constitutional Defender Dog. Is mainstream media giving you the real stories, or are they just telling you what they want you to hear?
Join us for Securing Liberty on Freedomizer Radio, Thursday evenings at 11 p.m. Central.
We'll be joined by great guests, discuss interesting and important topics, current events, maybe even a little humor. Be prepared for anything.
It will be 90 minutes of information sure to help you on your quest for truth. So join Securing Liberty at 11 p.m. Central on Freedomizer.
Join me, Valerie Ann, on the Truth Exposition Show at Freedomizer Radio in exposing the truth about FEMA camps, drone surveillance, martial law, the New World Order, our threatened freedoms and civil liberties, and for weekly news and current events. Mainstream media continues with its lies and deceit to fulfill the agenda of the New World Order. So please join me in exposing the truth, along with the lies and the deceptions that are being fed to the American people. The people of the United States have a voice, and your voice will be heard through Freedomizer Radio.
Welcome back to the Sports Lounge. This is JC, and with me right now is Steve from Las Vegas and Cleveland Ray from Cleveland. And what we're going to do is we're going to go into a version of True or False for NFL-related topics. We're also going to try to do some NBA-related topics for True or False and then segue from that point. Steve, first question, True or False? Mark Sanchez will be starting will be a starting quarterback in the NFL during week one of the 2013 season?
I would have to say, well, maybe. It'll be true if he's not in New York. New York doesn't want him as a starting quarterback. He's going to be either released or traded, more than likely traded because, well, it's going to cost him too much money to just cut him, although they just might do it. But if he is a starting quarterback, it won't be for the New York Jets. It'll be for a team like Kansas City that needs a starting quarterback, and knowing that they don't have a real quarterback in place, they're going to need him. We already know that Tebow is going to Jacksonville. So I doubt that a team like Jacksonville, who also needs a quarterback, is going to take him with Tebow in place because the owner of the Jacksonville Jaguars is, well, in love with Tebow. But if he is a starting quarterback, it's not going to be with the New York Jets next year.
Okay, and to add to what Steve just said, Sanchez next year gets $8.5 million under the salary cap, and if they cut him, they it's $17 to $18 million against the cap. So they
can
have to
I know I'm not a big football guy, but can I add in something?
Yes.
Okay, I don't think he will. I think that that there's a good chance that they could grab Geno Smith. Actually, how interesting would that be?
Which ties into what Steve said a little bit, because Kansas City, I think, is going to draft Geno Smith, just to let you know that. And if they brought in Sanchez, they can get Geno Smith. That could be the quarterback war. And the worst thing that happens is Sanchez ends up being Alex Smith for the 49ers, and Geno Smith ends up being Colin Kaepernick.
Okay. Well, that's my two cents. So, yeah.
It's very possible that they do that, knowing that their current quarterback Go ahead.
Sorry. Right, and it's possible that it's okay. It's possible that he could end up being the starting quarterback in New York since nobody may want to pick up the $8.5 million or the $17 million cap hit. So it's possible he'll end up in it with the Jets deal, and it's easier for them to pay out over 2 years than the $17 to $18 million in one. So that's possible too, where he starts the season, but a Geno Smith or Matt Barkley or Tyler Wilson ends up taking over shortly after. That's
or the owner just says, or the owner just says, I will eat that amount of money just to get rid of him.
Ouch.
That's very well possible too. We'll find out what that message is. Okay, next question. Tony Gonzalez will play one more year for the Falcons, Steve.
True. Tony Gonzalez has still got a lot left in the tank. He's proved it this year. He's proved it last year. He's a machine. He's a phenomenal athlete, and he's one that just keeps getting better and better. Yes, they're not throwing to him as much, but he still can get it done. He is better than a lot of the new guys coming up right now, and that's saying a lot because we've got some real good talent and guys like Jimmy Graham, but I believe he will be back for at least one more year.
Okay. Next question. Andy Reid will be head coach of another NFL team in 2013.
False. Andy Reid needs some time away from the NFL, from sports in general. He needs some time off. I think the league might recognize that, and I don't think anybody is going to want to touch him right away. He's a good coach, but in Philadelphia, he's showing that perhaps he needs some time away. And the NFL might not be willing to take a chance on Andy Reid for that very reason, especially considering what's been going on in his personal life.
Right, and what I'm hearing is the Chargers are waiting for Philadelphia to fire him on Black Monday, which is this coming Monday. And usually Black Monday is the Monday after the last regular season game. So if he gets fired on Monday, don't be surprised if North Turner gets fired on Tuesday and Andy Reid's the new head coach.
Well, I think, you know, if San Diego does that, they're going to prove that they aren't wanting to win. And that's a problem, especially if I were a fan of San Diego. I would be rather upset at the team for hiring a guy like Andy Reid who needs a break from coaching.
Understand. And finally, Adrian Peterson will have back-to-back 2,000-yard rushing season.
Ooh. It's possible. So, I'll say true. This guy is a machine as well. You would think that with the injury he suffered at the end of last season, he would have taken at least a year to a year and a half to recover completely and try to get back to form. But he's done it in a few months, which is incredible because I've not heard or seen any other athlete in his position be able to do that, especially at the running back position. I just don't think it's been done yet, and he did it. And he set a rushing record even after that injury. So if anyone can do it, he can. So I'm going to say true on this.
Hey. And the final one, who will be drafted in the first round of a majority of fantasy leagues?
Oh.
In 2013.
2013.
Oh, excuse me. Let me finish it. CJ Spiller will be drafted in the first round of fantasy leagues in 2013.
C.J. Spiller will be drafted. He won't be drafted number one by, you know, 1 through 10, I don't think. But yes, I would say he could be drafted in the first round of fantasy leagues next year.
Okay. Now, for 2013 breakout players, these are players that have yet to get past that hurdle. I'm going to give you a list of players, and you tell me which one you think stands the chance to be the breakout player 2013.
Okay.
C.J. Spiller, Josh Gordon, Kobe Fleener, T.Y. Hilton, Cecil Short, Noshawn Moreno, Vincent Brown, David Martin, Colin Kaepernick, or Russell Wilson?
Russell Wilson's a breakout player this year, so I'm not sure he can be counted considering what he's done this year. However, if anyone can do it, he could. But as far as a player who's done well this year and could do even better next year, I would say that would probably be Kobe Fleener for Indianapolis. He's got the quarterback, he's got the system he's in, and it is definitely showing that it uses their tight end quite often. So I could see Kobe Fleener being that breakout player next year.
Okay. And with that in mind, players on a downslide. This is your choice of players. Fred Jackson, Wes Welker, Bart Scott, Darrell Revis, Ray Lewis, Terrell Suggs, Andre Johnson, Maurice Jones-Drew, Carson Palmer, Philip Rivers, Brian Urlacher. Which one actually you see as a down is going to be that are hitting and going to have the biggest downslide next year?
Well, Carson Palmer is not even playing this year, and I doubt he will play it next year. So I'm going to go with Carson Palmer. I mean, the guy is obviously showing he's not the guy to be leading any kind of NFL offense. So it's going to be Carson Palmer.
Okay. Cleveland Ray?
Well, obviously it's got to be the guy who should be on Men of a Certain Age TV show, Brian Urlacher. That dude's got to be at least in his late 30s, and the fact that he can still hit and still be at the certain intensity that he is impressive all on its own. Ditto goes for Ray Lewis, how they've managed to be around for a very long time.
Hello?
A very long time, and somehow still be around and still hitting with the intensity that they have. I guarantee you they will have a down year next year.
Okay.
Maybe even next year be their last season.
Okay. Okay, are you going to compile your NBA question?
Well, what did you call? I don't believe. What did you call me? You called me a weird name there for a second. Did you say Ray?
No, I said Cleveland Ray.
Oh, okay, good. Well, yeah, I do have a couple quick questions here. Number one, right now the Boston Celtics sit at the 8th seed, one game behind Brooklyn for the 7th seed, and stand at two games, actually stand only a game behind Philadelphia for the 9th seed. Do the Celtics have any way possible in a talent-depleted East win, not make the playoffs?
Yes, they do. They actually do. A lot of people don't take into consideration with the Boston Celtics, and I'm really stunned that they actually won that NBA title, 3 years ago? But the Boston Celtics is probably, outside of the Lakers, the oldest team in the NBA. And, yes, there's a lot of work ethic there, but when Father Time comes knocking, things happen. And you compile that with a point guard who I think is not reliable in Rajon Rondo. I mean, one day he can get you a triple-double, and everybody's up for it and having a great time with him. And then the next day, he's a psych case. He needs to be locked up in a rubber room. And because of that unsurety and the fact that they're, you know, he's getting suspended for games and the roster can't stay solid, I see the Celtics as a team that may not make the playoffs.
Okay. Next question. Are the LA Clippers the next dynasty in the West?
I'm going to go ahead and – when you say the West, you mean the Western Conference?
The Western Conference, yes.
I'm going to go ahead and say true to that. I think they are, and I think that they are finally in a situation where they're going to get over the hump barring any future injuries with their star players. And the fact that they are a fairly young team, I think they're going to make – I don't think this year is their year, but I think next year they can actually have a better year than what they're doing this year. And as you and I both know, they're having a heck of a year right now. with this 24-6 record. At home, they're 14-3. On the road, they're 10-3. In the division, they're 5-1. So in the conference, they're 15-3. And they're averaging 102 points a game, and they're giving up 92 a game. So their point differential favors them as well. But they've won 16 in a row, and I think their better days are ahead of them, not behind them.
Is this San Antonio's final hurrah? They right now stand at the third best team in the West, but have up and coming teams such as Memphis, Golden State, Denver, Portland, and Utah chasing them as young and talented teams. Can a 39-year-old Tim Duncan fend off a 22-year-old Enes Kanter?
I'm going to say yes. The difference between San Antonio and most other teams is San Antonio has always been team-oriented, and Duncan himself may not be able to deal with this guy, but San Antonio as a team may be able to handle them as a team.
That is true, because for whatever reason, San Antonio can go deep into the draft and somehow pick up good talent, obviously, in players like Kawhi Leonard and the 7'6" monster of DeJuan Blair. Okay.
Correct.
Next question. Obviously, we saw P.J. Carlesimo take over the Brooklyn spot, and right now they are basically in a three-way tie for the fifth slot. The three-way tie is between them, Chicago, and Milwaukee. Does Brooklyn move up into the third slot over a surging, athletic, young Atlanta team?
Actually, Brooklyn is 15-14, and Milwaukee and Chicago are 15-12. And I think Brooklyn, what we see in Brooklyn is the fact that they may be in a situation where they're going to be declining. The problem with Brooklyn is Deron Williams. As gifted as he is, he's also one of those guys that he has these moments of being selfish, and he does things that puts him in the hot seat, per se, with the teams that he's with. Utah gave him away for a bucket of peanuts because they just got tired of him.
Utah got some good players. They got Devin Harris ended up being bad. I'll give you that. But Derek Favors, man, Derek Favors is developing really nicely.
He's developing.
Jefferson and Millsap.
Right, but Jefferson doesn't count because everybody's been trying to figure out what's going on with him. Millsap's in the same boat. The kid that you're talking about, he's developing. He's not at the quote-unquote same level as Deron Williams. And that's why I said a bucket of peanuts. Jerry Sloan even retired as a head coach because of Deron Williams. So I'm saying that Brooklyn is going to take a step back. They got
last but not least, final question. Interestingly enough, Orlando is only 5 games under 500 right now, and they're only in 10th place in the East. Obviously, Glenn Davis showed us in the postseason last year that he can definitely put up some big numbers. And granted, they lost Ryan Anderson. They still have players like Jameer Nelson and Hedo Turkoglu. Obviously, they're way more talent depleted than they were last year, but is there any chance Orlando can actually sneak into the playoffs after having the offseason that they did?
No. The problem with Orlando is the fact that they're a lot of the small things that was happening in Orlando is not happening now. Aflalo is doing good, which is ironic. Aaron Aflalo is the top point getter. He's averaging 16.8 points a game. J.J. Redick is doing fairly well, 14.3. The two guys I just mentioned don't seem to be doing well from the defensive side of the board, and that's where I think it's kind of like the Lakers. They have some decent offensive people, but unlike the Lakers, where the Lakers also have an aging issue, I think Orlando is in a situation where they just have lazy players.
Do have young players. Obviously, they got a lot of Mo Harkless. They've got Nikolai Vucevic. Do you mind, Glenn Davis is only going to be 25 or 26 when the season's over,
26.
So he's still a young and developing player as well. The only players that are really old, in my opinion, on that team are obviously Jameer Nelson, who's going to be 33, and Hedo Turkoglu, who should be at least in his mid-30s.
Yeah, Turkoglu is very old. He was old when he was at Sacramento. but they actually have, I'm going to say, six key players. The rest of them, I'm not going to go there. But I think they will miss the playoffs.
All right, well, that's all my NBA questions I have. I appreciate you playing along.
Hey, and I want to go ahead and thank both of you for coming on to the show. And next week, the show is going to be a little bit more revamped. The show's taking a new name. It's going to be called Sports Addicts, and we're going to try to liven it up with some confrontational, some more of the true or false things by sport, and try to get a little bit more flair into how we present the show as well. So join us starting next week with the first airing of Sports Addicts. Thank you again for being part of
the show. It's like the sports gods, but better.
But better.
It's not better. It's not like, I mean, it's like the sports lounge, but better.